You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
Monetary policy really defines the sovereignty of a country. It's the ability of a country to actually finance its own development through lending to the private sector, the building of public infrastructure, and so on. And that is ultimately what economic sovereignty is all about. It's the ability of a country to use its monetary instruments to finance development. And that ability is denied under the prevailing relations that these countries have with the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and the creditors.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Michelle Chosadovsky. Today's show, Neoliberalism and the New World Order. Michelle Chosadovsky is an economist and the founder, director, and editor of the Center for Research on Globalization, based in Montreal, Quebec. He is the author of 11 books, including The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th, America's War on Terrorism, and The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity. Today we discuss global financial war as outlined in Professor Chosadovsky's article, Wall Street Behind Brazil Coup d'Etat, the role played by the IMF and World Bank in the economies of debtor nations, the Real Plan in Brazil, the imposition of the Washington Consensus, loss of national sovereignty, neoliberal institution funding of grassroots movements, the main corporate actors of the New World Order, the function of propaganda, and the process of global impoverishment and destruction of nation states. Michelle Chosadovsky, welcome again.
Delighted to be on the program on these very important issues of the New World Order.
In our recent program, Global Warfare, Is the U.S. NATO Going to Attack Russia?, you talked about global nuclear, conventional, and non-conventional war. Non-conventional war includes global financial warfare. Let's take one of the most recent examples, regime change in Brazil. Your recent article, Wall Street Behind Brazil Coup d'Etat, lays out an argument that control over monetary policy and macroeconomic reform was the ultimate objective of the Brazilian coup d'etat against Dilma Rousseff. What is the evidence?
Well, the evidence is the following. When Luiz Inácio da Silva, President Lula, set up his government back in 2003, he appointed a former CEO of a Wall Street bank, Fleet Boston Financial Global Banking, to head the Central Bank of Brazil. And it was, in a sense, like appointing the fox in charge of the chicken coop, so to speak. And what was disturbing there is that all the major appointments which this progressive Workers' Party government implemented, namely the Ministry of Finance, the Central Bank, the Bank of Brazil, which is a development bank, they were held by neoliberals. And in fact, the IMF had given its support to the Lula government. And in fact, they even congratulated the Lula government on its austerity measures and so on. And Henrique de Campos Meirelles, who was president of the Central Bank of Brazil and also former president of Fleet Boston Financial Global Banking before he headed the Central Bank of Brazil, stayed in that position until the presidency of Lula's successor, Dilma Rousseff. And Dilma Rousseff, in fact, appointed a career Ministry of Finance official to head the central bank, and Meirelles was dropped from the government. Now, this was, from my standpoint, a very significant move because it was a message to Wall Street saying, we decide on key appointments in the spheres of economy and finance. And the coup, which led to the installation of a provisional government led by Michel Temer, it's an interim government, essentially what they did from one day to the next was to appoint a new finance minister who happened to be this notorious individual, Enrique de Campos Meirelles, a former CEO in Wall Street. He was appointed finance minister. And again, then they put together a team of appointments in the key positions. Now, it's not only the fact that Campos Meirelles is a Wall Street appointee, he's also a U.S. citizen. And Campos Meirelles then appoints his man to the central bank, whose name is Ilan Goldfein. And Ilan Goldfein was chief economist with one of Brazil's major private financial institutions. And Ilan Goldfein happens to be an Israeli citizen. And he also happens to be a very close friend of Stanley Fischer, who was previously number two at the IMF. And then he became governor of the Bank of Israel, and Stanley Fischer currently holds the number two position at the U.S. Federal Reserve. He's a vice chair of the U.S. Federal Reserve. And parenthesis, both Ilan Goldfein and Stanley Fischer have U.S. citizenship. Goldfein was head of the Central Bank of Brazil, was born in Israel, and he has dual citizenship. I'm not criticizing his citizenship, but I'm focusing on the crony relationships between these individuals. Okay? So now you have a central bank governor who has a close personal relationship with Stanley Fischer, number two at the Fed. Known and documented, it's always the number two man that calls the shots, ultimately, because that's where all the policy formulations are made. So that's the background. Now, where do, let's say, left progressive movements come in, or they came in right at the outset of the Lula administration, and European, North American, Latin American progressives applauded in chorus, celebrating the victory of a socialist government against the neoliberal agenda. And they said, victory against neoliberalism. It wasn't a victory against neoliberalism. It was, in fact, the co-optation of a workers' party leadership, not the grassroots, by Wall Street, with a whole set of Wall Street appointments, which started with Lula and up to a certain point was disrupted under Dilma Rousseff.
How much power does the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank wield over Brazil's economy?
Well, let me open a parenthesis there. Very often people say the IMF World Bank, they establish these harsh conditionalities on developing countries. They force them to implement austerity measures and so on and so forth. That is a correct description of IMF World Bank activities. The the structural adjustment programs that are imposed on developing countries are deadly. But it is not the IMF and the World Bank, which are in fact bureaucracies, which call the shots. The IMF and the World Bank are instruments of Wall Street. They're instruments of the private banking nexus. The IMF and the World Bank, they have their independence, their Bretton Woods institutions, but legally they are connected to the United Nations in a very hazy, it's a very hazy relationship, but they're supposed to be connected to the United Nations. In practice, they're not. But they don't call the shots. It's Wall Street that calls the shots. And it's very convenient for Wall Street to have these Washington-based institutions, which will then, through intergovernmental relations, will establish links with governments and so on and so forth. It's intergovernmental bodies. Now, what I'm suggesting here is that as far as appointments are concerned, the IMF, the World Bank, have a very significant impact. They're part of the so-called Washington consensus, which is also linked up to the Wall Street consensus. We notice that very often it's a former World Bank official which is appointed to the Ministry of Finance. That was the case in 1991 when Finance Minister in India, Manmohan Singh, who later became Prime Minister, he was appointed to the Ministry of Finance, and he implemented what was called a new economic policy, which led to devastation. It was supported by the World Bank. And in other words, the World Bank and the IMF, they have their people on the inside. I would say more the World Bank, because the World Bank can be in the ministries, it can be in the Ministry of Finance and the Ministry of Agriculture and so on. And ultimately, there's a consensus in terms of policy making which emerges. But then if you're talking about the impact that, let's say, these loan agreements have, they're devastating because they will say you have to cut your budget in all the social sectors, health, education, etc. You have to close down the hospitals, close down or privatize some of the schools, introduce user fees. And in effect, what these institutions do is to precipitate countries into poverty. And they also contribute to the destabilization of the national economy. And we see that in many countries. In Venezuela, in fact, what they've done is very similar to what they did, or has some relationship to what they did in Chile in 1973. They create conditions of collapse of commodity markets, scarcity of commodities, rising inflation, breakdown of distribution of goods, not to mention problems of urban security and organized crime, et cetera, in Caracas. Those are engineered conditions. And, of course, they've also created conditions which have bankrupted the state because the price of oil has collapsed from over $100 a barrel to something of the order of $30 a barrel. And this has contributed to the bankruptcy of the Venezuelan government.
What is the Real plan in Brazil?
It is very important. Really the Real plan is a plan to essentially dollarize all internal debt operations so that the country doesn't really have a monetary policy. It links the national currency to the dollar, and it means that it has to be supported by forex transactions to maintain that parity. And then it really means that whenever, let's say, if you want to use your monetary policy to mobilize internal resources, it turns out to be dollarized. It's the same plan that they had in Argentina under Menem.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, neoliberalism, and the New World Order. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
You write that, quote, the objective of the coup d'etat was to deny Brazil's sovereignty in the formulation of macroeconomic policy. Why is Wall Street or the United States against a nation's sovereignty?
Well, that's a very important question. And it really has to do with monetary policy. Monetary policy really defines the sovereignty of a country. It's the ability of a country to actually finance its own development through, through lending to the private sector, the building of public infrastructure, and so on. And to do that, you have to be able to increase the levels of internal debt. I mean, we do it in the United States and Canada and so on. We use debt operations to fund the infrastructure, roads, schools and hospitals, okay? But what is at stake in developing countries is that the currency is dollarized and it's upheld by, in currency markets, it's upheld by dollar-denominated debts, which have to be incurred to support the currency, so that when you start expanding the money supply to finance development, you really, it's a difficult and complex mechanism, you really have to borrow in dollars. And really what it means is that your currency really is a proxy. It's a dollarized currency. So that each time you want to build a road or a bridge or a hydroelectric complex, using your domestic resources, you have to increase your indebtedness in dollar terms. In other words, the internal debt becomes a foreign debt. And that is ultimately what happened in Brazil with the Real Plan. The Real Plan established the Real as the Brazilian currency on a peg with the U.S. dollar, you know, sustained by persistent propping up of the currency to maintain that parity. And what it meant is that Brazil was indebting itself in terms of dollars. And each time it expands its, let's say, its levels of expenditure and so on and so forth, it ultimately has to borrow in dollars. And what that means, to get back to the question, is that it's Wall Street that controls monetary policy, and all actions of internal development, funding infrastructure, schools, roads, and so on, requires borrowing dollars to do it. And I'll give one example of this is Vietnam in the wake of its normalization with the United States decided to initiate a major project of repairing the country's main highway which links the capital, Hanoi, in the north to Ho Chi Minh City, or what was formerly known as Saigon. It's called Road Number One, okay? You know, the East Coast of the United States also has a road, linking New York right down to Miami. And what happened is that the project was to repair the road. And for that, they had to have an international tender by construction companies coming in, big multi-million dollar, contracts. And to repair the road, they needed foreign capital. But in fact, what the foreign capital would do was to subcontract with local enterprises, which then would build the road. And what happens under that type of mechanism is the transformation of an internal debt into an external debt. And you don't need to bring in foreign capital to repair a road or even to build a road. The technologies are there. The know-how is there. And you don't need much investment in terms of capital or materials. It's all local. And that is the mechanics, is that immediately these financial institutions, once they normalize with the country, they will say, okay, we're going to lend you money on the World Bank project to build a road, but it has to be an offer of tender to international construction companies, blah, blah, blah. And then the money we lend you, you use it to pay these companies. And that's how countries get indebted. And they are unable, under World Bank, IMF auspices, to mobilize internal debt operations. And I've seen this in numerous countries. There's what is called the PIP, Public Investment Program, which is a list of projects. And the World Bank ultimately goes through this list, and they can choose which ones they want to finance. And they override the government in the choice of investment projects. And that is ultimately what economic sovereignty is all about. It's the ability of a country to use its monetary instruments to finance development. And that ability is denied under the prevailing relations that these countries have with the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and the creditors.
Well, then, it's true that if a country can issue its own debt internally, then they can control that policy and the effects it have. But if the debt is externalized, then all of the control is taken away from them, right?
Precisely. I mean, you've formulated exactly that is the nature of that relationship, is that once they are brought into the nexus of these international financial institutions, which monitor their investment projects and provide funding, well, then that funding is external, is dollarized, and in turn it is then subject to conditionalities imposed by the creditors of a policy nature. So they will say, oh, we helped you build that road, and you now have a $50 million, $100 million debt. You now have to repay that debt. And then the government said, well, we don't have any money to repay it. And then they will say, okay, we'll lend you money, but then you have to accept certain policy conditionalities, which we will impose. In other words, close down your hospitals and your schools. That's the way these austerity measures work. And then they'll say, well, you have to privatize. So that, in effect, the process of making countries indebted is the key to taking control of their sovereignty. Now, in the European Union, the mechanics are somewhat different. There's the famous Maastricht Treaty, which goes back prior to the Eurozone. And the Maastricht Treaty stipulates essentially that or establishes the basis whereby the individual member states cannot fund their development from central bank operations. And ultimately then, of course, you have the European Central Bank. And this, in a sense, creates conditions whereby the individual member states, particularly the weaker ones, like Greece, Ireland, Portugal, virtually their sovereignty is derogated because they can't use their resources. They don't have a national currency to finance their own development. And then what happens is that their assets are taken over, privatization, impoverishment, and so on and so forth. We see it happening in several European countries. Greece is, of course, a notorious example where this mechanism has occurred. And the European Central Bank, in effect, is playing a role which is, in some regards, similar to that of the IMF, In another context, of course, the IMF is acting in relation to Brazil, but the IMF more recently has also acted in relation to countries like Greece and Portugal.
Right, and I think it's important for people to understand that if a government creates its own debt or creates its own credit, it can use that to help the economy and not to destroy it. Like, for instance, let's just say theoretically that the Fed in the U.S., let's say it was part of the Treasury or even as it is now privatized, if they issued no-interest loans to states or whatever, they could use that to help the economy rather than destroy it, right?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the thing is, it's not money which creates real wealth. By real wealth or real economy wealth, by real wealth, I mean, I'm not talking about the wealth of individuals. I'm talking about infrastructure, schools, hospitals, roads, and so on. The resources in the United States of America are there. It's the real economy. It's the people plus the resources plus the equipment and so on, which ultimately will lead to projects. And then you need mechanisms which will mobilize those resources. And they could be loans at 0% interest, or they could be, of course, commercial loans at very high interest. And they could be all sorts of impediments to the increase of public expenditure in support of projects, because again, the Treasury is ultimately under the surveillance of Wall Street, of the Federal Reserve, which in turn is also an appendage of Wall Street. So that, you know, monetary policy is central to any kind of societal project. That's why the debate, let's say, on the democratization of monetary policy is so crucial, of the banking system in general. So that if we have a banking system which is controlled by J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs and Citigroup and so on, we're not going to necessarily be able to fund the things that we want to fund. We'll be funding casinos, we'll be funding, entertainment complexes and hotels and so on. But we're not going to be funding the basic social infrastructure, which will uplift the standard of living of millions of people. And I think that is the situation which characterizes U.S. monetary policy. I should mention that a large share of public expenditure is, of course, allocated to produce weapons. It's the military-industrial complex. It's the so-called defense contractors. And those, require, well, it has to do with government debt. It has to do with spending patterns. It has to do with the Treasury. But, again, when creditors call the shots and decide what has to be funded in terms of infrastructure, the tendency is to fund precisely areas such as defense rather than schools and hospitals.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, Neoliberalism and the New World Order. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
So then, using Brazil as an example, what is the effect then of imposing the Washington consensus on Brazil? How does it benefit the U.S., and what are the negative effects on Brazil?
Well, the case of Brazil is certainly not unique. I think what distinguishes Brazil from other developing countries, particularly Latin America, is that, first of all, it has a population of over 200 million people. It's a large country in its own right, with tremendous resources and infrastructure and so on. But what characterizes this relationship, let's say, between Washington, Wall Street on the one hand and Brazil on the other, is the fact that by taking control of monetary policy, you ultimately take control of the real resources of a country. The objective is not simply to occupy the central bank or the Ministry of Finance. The objective is ultimately to be able to take control over major areas of Brazil's economic development process through privatization, through the buy-up of Brazilian companies and so on and so forth. We've seen this developing in the course of the last, I would say, in the course of the last 20 years, U.S. dominant financial and economic corporate interests are appropriating large sectors of this wealthy economy. We're talking about resources, mining, forestry, but also industrial development. The name of the game is privatization. And countries like Brazil, but let's take another case, countries like South Korea with tremendous industrial capabilities. When the IMF imposed its devastating reforms in 1997, during the so-called Asian crisis, it imposed it on South Korea, the objective was ultimately to confiscate real assets, literally to confiscate real assets. But they didn't only confiscate real assets, they took over banking. They took over research institutes. Ultimately, through financial manipulation, you acquire oversight on another country's resources. You will find similar occurrences in other countries. And to get back to Brazil, Brazil is a very wealthy country, and there's lots of assets to be taken over. And we see that now the rules of the game is to take over assets. We see it in Greece now with the conditions imposed by German, French, and American creditors on the Greek Ministry of Finance. So that is the order of the day, is that it's not only sovereignty which is at stake, it's the plunder of national economies by international financial institutions, leading to transfer of wealth, whereby these U.S. companies take over large sectors of the economy through a process of manipulation.
In your article, Counterpropaganda as an Instrument of Peace, Fidel Castro and the Battle of Ideas, the Dangers of Nuclear War, you write that, quote, a worldwide process of impoverishment is an integral part of the New World Order agenda. Describe what you consider to be the New World Order.
Well, the New World Order is a hegemonic project of ultimately conquering sovereign countries and, in a sense, corporatizing their governments. It's the very structures of macroeconomic reform, but it's also the trade initiatives, the TTIP, the TPP, the two major areas of trade integration, the Atlantic and the Pacific, which ultimately transfer the powers of policymakers into the hands of corporations. Now, that, in effect, has already occurred. We don't have independent governments, sovereign governments anymore, even in Western countries. We can go back to, let's say, to the era in Europe, we might go back to Charles de Gaulle, or in Britain, we might go back to Harold Wilson. But those types of heads of state, heads of government are no longer around. And in the United States, we have individuals which are really the instruments of the corporate lobby groups. They're not providing any leadership. I don't think that Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton can provide any leadership with regard to decision making. They will abide by the instructions which are transmitted to them by their corporate sponsors. And then, of course, there's also a consensus as to what is politically correct, as to what you do. The New World Order is a global capitalist system it is based on hegemony. It's based on military power. I think one would also say that it is characterized by the outright criminalization of politics. The fact that we don't really have honest people in government anymore, very few. It's also the fact that in the course of the last 20 or 30 years, all socialist and or social democratic projects have been eliminated in one form or another. We can think of Nicaragua, you know, back in the early 80s, of course, Guatemala, Salvador as well. We can think of Vietnam, obliterated through the Vietnam War, Cambodia, Indonesia from the, you know, from the early 60s, early mid-60s. We can look at Chile, Argentina, Mozambique, Angola, numerous countries, Algeria, numerous countries whose project has been obliterated and destroyed. In other words, there's no longer any nationalism, and there's no longer any reformist government which acts on behalf of its population, and there's no longer any what we might call representative government. That is the New World Order. It's the concentration of power by corporations. It is also, it's not necessarily a smooth process because those corporations are waging their own battle against one another. They're merging, they're buying up, they have manipulations directed against their competitors. But ultimately, what's happening is that the world is being precipitated beyond poverty. It's no longer an issue of mass poverty. It's also an issue of total despair. In other words, we had an era where we talked about the globalization of poverty. I spent many years investigating that theme. But I have the hunch that now we're talking about something quite different. It's beyond the globalization of poverty. It's not only the impoverishment of large sectors of the world population. It is precipitating people into total despair, and it's the destruction of the institutional fabric, the collapse of schools, hospitals, which are closed down, the legal system disintegrates, borders are redefined. And essentially this stage, which goes beyond impoverishment, is the transformation of countries into territories. And we see it occurring in the Middle East. The objective for Iraq and Libya and Yemen is certainly to transform a country into a territory, and then you recolonize it. You're in a very different environment to that which has prevailed until recently.
What are the main corporate actors of the New World Order?
Well, I would say, broadly speaking, that the main corporate actors of the New World Order, first of all, it's Wall Street and the Western banking conglomerates, and that includes also the offshore facilities, the Cayman Islands, and so on. We've talked a lot about that with the Panama Papers, but in effect, all those offshore locations are controlled by the large banking institutions. And, of course, it's also linked up to money laundering and drugs and so on. The military-industrial complex, at least that's what Eisenhower called it, regrouping the so-called defense contractors. They're not defense contractors, they're war contractors. The security, the mercenary companies, the intelligence outfits on contract to the Pentagon, the large private security companies such as R4S, which in some sense was also connected to the Orlando events. Then you have, of course, the energy companies, the Anglo-American oil and energy giants. They're very important. And then you have the biotech conglomerates, which increasingly control agriculture and the food chain. Monsanto is of course, part of that. Monsanto, Cargill, and the big corporate food companies are part of that. Then overlapping with the biotech conglomerates, you have Big Pharma, the large pharmaceutical companies. And I should say that those large pharmaceutical companies, they also overlap with the military-industrial complex because they also produce chemical and biological weapons. And then you have, of course, the communications giants, the media conglomerates, which are part of the propaganda arm of the New World Order. And there's overlap between all these various, these are very broad categories, but I think that essentially, to summarize, Wall Street and the Western banking conglomerates, the military-industrial complex, the Anglo-American oil and energy giants, the biotech conglomerates, Big Pharma, and the global media conglomerates.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, Neoliberalism and the New World Order. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Describe the process by which local protest grassroots movements against neoliberal policy are co-opted by the very forces of neoliberalism.
Well, this is a very important question, because the consequences of neoliberalism, as we see in different parts of the world, create conditions of mass protest. And what has occurred is that the seats of power, the New World Order, primarily Wall Street, the financial conglomerates, they not only control the governments which are implementing these neoliberal policies, but they also indirectly control the protest movement, which is funded by the corporate tax-free foundations. It's not to say that all protest movements are funded by Wall Street, but in effect, if we start to look into the whole nexus of non-governmental organization, what we have is that many of these organizations, NGOs, civil society organizations, historically linked to the protest movement, are in fact funded by private foundations, including the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Bacardi Foundations, among others. The Tides Foundation has a mandate to fund progressive organizations. It's a multi-million dollar foundation. And it just so happens that the Tide Foundation is then receiving grants from several of the corporate foundations, including the Rockefellers and the Fords. So that what is at stake is that the entities which are opposed to neoliberalism are, in a sense, funded by neoliberalism. You take the situation, let's say, of Occupy Wall Street. Well, Occupy Wall Street, on the one hand, has a mandate to go against Wall Street, okay? But then when you start to examine who is behind them, who is funding them, they're funded by tax-free foundations. So Wall Street funds the protest movement against Wall Street. Very convenient. Now, just to go back to Brazil, because it's very important, is that at the inception of Lula's government in 2002-2003, the World Social Forum was created, and what were they doing? They were celebrating the victory of the PT government, of the Workers' Party of Brazil, over neoliberalism. Yet, if we go back to the origins of the World Social Forum, well, the World Social Forum was funded by the Ford Foundation. And we know that the Ford Foundation has links to U.S. intelligence, in fact, historical links to U.S. intelligence. And there we can quote a former president of the Ford Foundation who said, and I quote, everything the Ford Foundation did could be regarded as making the world safe for capitalism, reducing social tensions by helping to comfort the afflicted, provide safety valves for the angry, and improve the functioning of government. Okay? That is the mandate of the Ford Foundation. It's to fund people who don't like the capitalist system, who are protesting, but at the same time, you establish the limits of dissent. And in a sense, you manufacture dissent. And in essence, by providing the funding as well as the policy framework, these tax-free foundations are in a position to manipulate and to establish the boundaries of dissent. And my experience is that the ritual of the elites consists in inviting so-called civil society leaders into their inner circles with a view to establishing dialogue and so on and so forth. And ultimately, what this consists in is essentially to co-opt them. And you co-opt them by financing them. And the World Social Forum is a good example of that. And many of these non-governmental organizations have been caught in the nexus of corporate funding, and they are consequently not in a position really to challenge the fundamental goals of this New World Order agenda.
How does propaganda function as an integral part of the New World Order? For example, is intelligence embedded in the mass media? And then, as well, could you talk about some of the alternative media?
Well, certainly the mass media or the mainstream media has historical links to intelligence agencies. This is known and documented. It's clear that the mainstream media is there to support a consensus with regard to foreign policy. It's there to distort events. But it's got to such an extent, because the mainstream media hasn't always been like that. I mean, if we go back to the Vietnam War, well, we had critical reporting on what was happening up to a point. But if we start to look and see how does the mainstream media cover the war in Syria, well, they forget to mention that ISIS, the Islamic State, is supported covertly by the United States. And they actually will admit it, and then they will in a sense refute their own lies. They will admit it in so and so many words. They'll say, oh, Turkey and Saudi Arabia are supporting the ISIS, but Turkey and Saudi Arabia are allies of the United States. Saudi Arabia doesn't act without consulting Washington. So there we have a mainstream media which has evolved towards essentially presenting the lie as the truth. And that's a fundamental relationship, because when the lie becomes the consensus, there's no turning backwards. And when I say the lie becomes the truth, or the lie becomes the consensus, is to say the United States is waging a war against terrorists. But you fail to mention that the terrorists are actually funded by the United States, and they were created by the CIA. And everybody knows that, but at the same time, we don't really believe in it anymore, and we believe in the lie. So it's not to say that the truth is obfuscated. It's a different mechanism. It's the truth which becomes the lie, and the lie becomes the truth, so that people have to believe the lie, even though they know that the lie is a lie. It's not the truth, so to speak. I give you another example. We know that the torture chambers in Guantanamo, everybody knows it, okay? And nobody is in the process of hiding it. But what the media will do is to provide legitimacy to torture. It will also provide legitimacy to going in and killing people in Libya, or assassinating the head of state, or bombing. Well, Syria is more complex, because there they say that the bombing is done by the government against their own people. But of course, that lie is difficult to. it doesn't really hold up anymore. But essentially that is what is at stake, is that the media, as an instrument of propaganda, has turned realities upside down. It has created a consensus which people dare not question. It upholds war as a humanitarian endeavor. It upholds war as a humanitarian endeavor, as a peacemaking undertaking. And in effect, what this means is that both politics as well as the media are criminalized, because we have criminals in high office which are involved in making war in the name of peace, and then we have a media which serves as propaganda to uphold those lies, and at the same time it means that the media is complicit in the criminalization of the state. Without the media serving as an instrument of propaganda, the military agenda would not have a leg to stand on. The whole construct of U.S. foreign policy would collapse like a deck of cards if it were subjected to truthful analysis within the media and confrontation and so on. But that does not happen. And there you have the complicity of, you have also the complicity of intellectuals, and you have the complicity of the universities, of the think tanks, and so on. There's a politically correct way of studying, let's say, international affairs, which is set. You don't discuss the role of the United States in supporting terrorist organizations. You don't underscore the fact that 30% of the population of North Korea was wiped out due to U.S. bombings. You don't say anything about the almost 1 million Indonesians who were assassinated on orders of the CIA in the mid-60s. All of this, of course, is documented in the archives, but it's never the object of any kind of debate. And then history is erased, okay? History is erased, and we are led to believe that the United States is involved in a global crusade to instill democracy and Western values. There's a lot of skepticism, however, which is unfolding in relation to media disinformation. Now, you asked the question on the alternative media. And the alternative media, I think, is also going through a period of crisis, because there are certain segments of the alternative media which, in fact, are controlled by the mainstream. There's a whole issue of half-truths and half-lies. Then there's the issue of saying, well, you know, we're fighting terrorism, but if we had proceeded otherwise, they wouldn't be terrorist organizations. But still, again, the fundamental truths are not revealed in many of these alternative media formulations. And what I think is very important, if we want to disarm a military agenda, we need a very cohesive counter-propaganda campaign. And we have to wage that counter-propaganda campaign without being funded by those who are behind the propaganda campaign, so to speak. That's the problem with some of the alternative media. They're funded by corporate foundations, so that they are, in a sense, very much limited in the things that they can say against the New World Order. Again, if I'm thinking of the United States, the links that progressive groups have to the Democratic Party, of course, is a constraint in their ability to, let's say, to take a position with regard to major issues of U.S. foreign policy.
Michel Chosadovsky, thank you very much.
Well, delighted to be on the program again. Something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
and speaking with Michelle Chosadovsky. Today's show has been Neoliberalism and the New World Order. Michelle Chosadovsky is the founder, director, and editor of the Center for Research on Globalization, based in Montreal, Quebec. The Global Research website, globalresearch.ca, publishes news articles, commentary, background research, and analysis. Michelle Chosadovsky is the author of 11 books, including The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th, America's War on Terrorism, The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity, as well as co-editor of the anthology The Global Economic Crisis, The Great Depression of the 21st Century. All books are available at globalresearch.ca. That's globalresearch.ca. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at G&B Radio.
Of the mind. If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now, if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are written on the walls of life, then universally we will stand, and divided we will fall, because love conquers all. You understand what I'm saying? This is a call to all you sleeping souls. Wake up and take control of your own cipher, and be on the lookout for the spirit sniper trying to steal your life. You know what I'm saying? Look inside yourself for peace. Give thanks, live life, and release. You dig me? You got me?
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week and next, Adam Curtis's new film, Bitter Lake. It's about Saudi Arabia and Afghanistan, and about why the best move the U.S. and Britain could make in Afghanistan is to get the heck out. I hope you'll stay tuned. Adam Curtis, the British documentary filmmaker, has a new movie just out. This one focuses on two hotspot countries of the Near East, countries whose recent history is closely connected. The two countries are Saudi Arabia and Afghanistan. One of the connections is Saudi Arabia's reactionary and militant form of Islam known as Wahhabism. The United States continues to keep its pledge to support and defend Saudi Wahhabism in exchange for oil. Despite what Saudi Wahhabism did to the World Trade Center on 9/11/2001. Or so Adam Curtis argues. Being Adam Curtis, he connects these themes with a whole lot of other ills plaguing the West. For instance, politicians who don't believe in governing. They've basically handed over the governing power to the big banks. The banks have used this power mainly to enrich themselves and to increase their own power further. And they've gotten fatter still on Saudi Arabian petrodollars. And the film is about blowback, about disastrous consequences that nobody had considered as they were preparing the ground for them. Typical Adam Curtis. And if Curtis once again bites off more than he can chew, or maybe chews a bit more than he can digest, anyway, the results are still very interesting indeed. And the modern history of Saudi Arabia and Afghanistan is fascinating. And it helps show that the only sensible course of action for any country trying to rebuild Afghanistan in its own image, let alone trying to invade and conquer the country, the only sane course of action is to get the heck out before Afghanistan destroys you. The British learned this the hard way in the 19th century. The Russians learned this the hard way in the 1980s. The American government has no intention of learning anything from anyone else or even from experience. So the U.S.-led NATO invasion and occupation of Afghanistan is working about as well as everyone else's ever worked. Bitter Lake is the name of the film. That's probably the lake created by a massive American-led dam project in Helmand Province in the 1950s. That project was designed to turn Afghanistan into a modern, prosperous, Western-style democracy. Failed again. Bitter Lake also refers to the Russian science fiction film Solaris. That had a lake that destroyed the minds of everyone who got near it. A nice metaphor for the region. The film is about 2.25 hours long, so we won't hear it all. But this week and next, at least, we'll hear a good part of the first half of it. And probably more later. Skillfully adapted to radio by yours truly, here is Adam Curtis's Bitter Lake.
Increasingly, we live in a world where nothing makes any sense. Events come and go like waves of a fever, leaving us confused and uncertain. Those in power tell stories to help us make sense of the complexity of reality. But those stories are increasingly unconvincing and hollow.
Excuse me, I'm lost.
This is a film about why those stories have stopped making sense and how that led us in the West to become a dangerous and destructive force in the world. It is told through the prism of a country at the center of the world, Afghanistan. In 1946, American engineers, along with their wives and families, began to arrive at a dusty airstrip in Helmand in southern Afghanistan. They worked for the biggest construction company in the world, called Morrison Knudsen. And the King of Afghanistan had brought them there to build a giant planned new world. A complex of dams, canals, roads, and even a new model city. The King's aim was to harness the power of the giant Helmand River and turn his country into a modern society, just like in the West.
The Asiatic Kingdom of Afghanistan is located roughly 10,000 miles from either coastline of the United States, almost directly on the opposite side of the globe, westward from China, beyond the Himalayas. It is a landlocked country, bordered on the north by the Soviet Union, and on the east by Pakistan, and on the west by Iran.
The king was called Zahir Shah, and he often came to visit the project. Afghanistan was a deeply conservative country, and he was determined to modernize it. What the king was trying to create in Helmand was a copy of what President Roosevelt had done in America in the 1930s. And the company he had hired, Morrison Knudsen, had worked back then for Roosevelt, building a new world of dams and power stations across America. Now they were going to do the same for Afghanistan. The engineers and their families lived in a complex of houses around the king's country palace in Helmand. It became known as Little America. At the end of the Second World War, President Roosevelt travelled to the Great Bitter Lake in the middle of the Suez Canal. At the same time, he sent another American warship to pick up the King of Saudi Arabia, King Abdulaziz. The meeting of King and President was to have powerful and disastrous consequences, both for the West and, in a strange way, for Afghanistan. Roosevelt was dying, but over the last 13 years, he had used his power on an epic scale to transform the world. After the Wall Street crash and the terrible depression that followed, Roosevelt had taken charge. He had passed laws that broke up the banks, so they would never run out of control again. And he had rebuilt America with a series of giant dams that brought electrical power and employment to millions of people. And he had planned and fought a world war against Germany and Japan. Now, as Roosevelt sat waiting for Abdulaziz, no one could possibly have imagined the consequences of this meeting. For it was going to unleash forces that in the future would undermine everything that Roosevelt had worked for. His belief that politicians should use their power in a planned way to reshape the world. But Roosevelt knew that to keep that power, America needed oil. And he wanted to forge an alliance with the king to make sure that the vast Saudi oil fields remained under American control. In their conversation, the two men laid the foundations for an alliance that continues to the present day. America would get its oil, and in return, Saudi Arabia would receive wealth and security from America. But the king was well aware of the dangers of opening up his country to the influence of the modern West. And in the negotiations that followed, he laid down a condition. "We will take your technology and your money," he said, "but you must leave our faith alone." The Saudi faith was called Wahhabism. It was a radical, violent, and extremely puritanical form of Islam. And its followers among the Bedouin tribes hated the modern world. Wahhabism was part of a wider movement in Islam that had risen up in reaction to the European empires. Another was the Deobandi movement in India. They all believed that modern imperialism was corrupting the true nature of Islam. and wanted to go back to a world based on the original teachings of the Islamic texts. Abdulaziz had harnessed this force in the 1920s to seize power. But he had unleashed something that didn't want to stop. The Wahhabists wanted to go on and create a caliphate across the whole of the Arab world. And to stop them, in 1929, Abdulaziz machine-gunned them. He ruthlessly killed the warriors who had made him king. But their belief, a violent, intolerant, and above all backward-looking version of Islam, remained at the heart of Saudi Arabian society. And the deal made that day on the Great Bitter Lake meant that America would get its oil, but it would also be protecting Wahhabism, a force that had its own global ambitions. Ambitions that were very different from America's.
A state funeral procession. Ahmad Shah Massoud had been the great hope for a future Afghanistan. But he had been killed by Osama bin Laden in 2001.
By the mid-1950s, the American engineers had built the giant dams that were going to create what they called a new wonderland of vegetation and power in Helmand. But the project was running into problems, and it was beginning to lose its innocence. As the giant dams were completed, they had an unexpected effect. They raised the level of the water table and started to bring salt to the surface. And one of the plants that thrived in this new soil were poppies. Some of those leading the project said they should stop. But the American government stepped in and insisted that they should continue. Because by now, the dams had become a central part of the struggle with the Soviet Union. All sides in the Cold War began to compete to offer Afghanistan bigger and better schemes to modernize the country. Afghan politicians exploited this ruthlessly. The Prime Minister, Mohammed Daoud, spent his time traveling the world, playing the countries, Russia, America and China, off against each other. Daoud wanted to use the modernization as a way of consolidating his power. Afghanistan was a fragmented country. Power was divided between ethnic groups and tribes. Daoud was a Pashtun, and he saw how the dam project in Helmand could be used to consolidate the Pashtun grip on the whole country. He persuaded the Americans to make the project even bigger, to turn it into a giant piece of social engineering. Thousands of Pashtun nomads, who spent their time roaming the border area with Pakistan, would be settled in the new farmland created by the dams. Daoud presented it as just another innocent piece of modernization, and the Americans happily agreed. What they didn't realize was that they were unwittingly being sucked into Afghan power politics. Not only was Daoud increasing Pashtun power, but he was sowing the seeds of bitter rivalries over the division and ownership of land in Helmand. In 1964, King Faisal became the new leader of Saudi Arabia. Faisal set out to modernize the country. He created Western-style bureaucracies and a welfare system. He even allowed television for the first time. But he faced two threats. One was from the religious leaders inside Saudi Arabia. They were the Wahhabists, who had brought his family to power and gave his rule legitimacy. They distrusted any idea of modernizing Saudi society. Faisal was also facing a dangerous situation abroad, from communism that was spreading through the Arab world. His solution was simple. Faisal decided to use the religious leaders and their conservative beliefs as a force to counter the international threat of communism. but he knew that this would also divert their attention away from his domestic policies. Faisal used the growing oil money to set up hundreds of schools and institutes across the Islamic world, some as far away as Pakistan. Their job was to spread Wahhabist ideas and help to turn Islam into a unified international force strong enough to stand up to communism. What Faisal was doing was taking the dangerous and unstable fanaticism at the heart of Saudi society and directing it outwards, beyond its borders. It was a ruthless way of creating stability in his own country. America gave this tacit approval because it was part of the global struggle against communism. But in 1966, Faisal gave America a glimpse of how uncontrollable an ally Saudi Arabia could be. He went to New York and publicly attacked America's support for Israel. It caused an outrage.
Andrew and I wanted the dogs to look their very best because we were taking them out on a special assignment. We were all going off to the Mall, and we had to be there by 12 o'clock.
Come on then, dogs.
We felt very proud of Kingsley and Cleo because they'd been invited to join a guard of honour. Afghan Huns were going to salute their king because for the first time ever, the King of Afghanistan was coming to London. About 20 members of the Southern Afghan Hound Society had brought their dogs along to line the route, and there were Afghans of all colours and sizes. And when the Queen pointed us out, the King of Afghanistan seemed delighted to see us. For the first time in their lives, British Afghan Hounds were seeing people from their own country, because in the carriages that followed the Queen, there were more people from the Royal Court of Afghanistan.
But the ordered world, where kings and queens ruled and dogs behaved obediently, was about to collapse. In 1971, the King of Afghanistan had come on his first ever state visit to Britain. But it was also his last, because his ambitious Prime Minister, Mohammed Daoud, was already plotting against him. And in 1973, Daoud took power in a coup. He declared Afghanistan a republic and sent the king into exile. Two months later, Egypt attacked Israel, and a Middle East war started. To begin with, it looked as though Israel would be defeated. But the American government came to its rescue, airlifting arms on a massive scale to prevent the Israelis from being overwhelmed. The Israelis counterattacked, and the Arabs faced a disaster. But then Saudi Arabia came to the rescue, because King Faisal realized that his country had a weapon that could stop Israel. Overnight, Faisal raised the price of oil 5 times and threatened a complete embargo unless America forced Israel to pull back. It worked. A ceasefire was agreed. And everyone realized that the balance of power in the world had suddenly changed.
Saudi oil minister Sheikh Zaki Yamani.
What we want is the complete withdrawal of the Israeli forces from the occupied Arab territories. And then you'll have the oil at the same level of September 73.
Is this demand absolute and rigid, or is this just a negotiating position?
Definitely. We won't give up any inch of these lands.
Doesn't this new massive increase in the price of oil mean a change in the world balance of power between the developing nations like you, the producers, and us, the developed industrialized nations?
Yes, it will.
And what do you think arises from that?
Well, a new type of relationship. You have to adjust yourself to the new circumstances. And I think you have to sit down and talk seriously with us about this new era.
When Saudi Arabia raised the price of oil, they did it to change the political balance of power in the world. But it also had another unexpected effect, because it allowed the men who ran the banks and the financial system in America and Britain to begin to break free of political control. Billions of dollars flooded from the West into Saudi Arabia, most of which the Saudis didn't know what to do with. So they gave them to the Western banks to invest. The banks then made a crucial decision. They kept many of those dollars free from control by the American government. And they became a vast pool of wealth, known as petrodollars, that could be lent and traded anywhere around the world without political control. As Western politicians struggled to deal with the economic and social chaos that had been created by the oil price rise, their bankers were building a new global financial system based on recycling the Saudi billions. And the banks began to become rich and powerful again. As Western countries collapsed economically in the 1970s, students from Europe and America fled from the chaos. They came to Afghanistan as a land of dreams, a different, innocent world, free of the corruption of politics and money in the West.
A traveller is someone who proceeds through a country under his own initiative, with a certain internal drive to learn, to find out something more than the superficial. To me, an Afghan was some figure from a woodblock print in a book about India. The reality of an Afghan was so beyond that, their strength of character, which comes through in their most simple action.
But Afghan students still believe in the idea of revolution. Back in the 1960s, many students from Kabul University had been sent to universities in America. It had been part of the modernization project, and they brought back with them radical ideas from the American student left. Back in Kabul, those ideas then got mixed up with other left-wing theories that the Afghan students found in badly translated Russian books about Marxism. And in 1978, they decided to have a revolution. One of the leaders was Hafizullah Amin, and after the revolution, he ordered a film to be made about the role he had played. Amin also starred in the film, playing himself. It shows policemen coming to Amin's house to arrest him. He tries to hide some secret papers. But the policemen take him to jail, leaving his wife and daughter. Amin is then shown directing the revolution from his prison cell, and then riding on a tank to the president's palace.
Tanks loyal to young communist army officers now guard the palace where President Daoud ruled. Inside, he and his family, including his young grandchildren, were shot dead when his palace guard lost their courageous battle to defend him. Men from the different tribes who live in this backward country swarm all over tanks knocked out in the battle. They seem pleased to see the end of the old feudal regime.
The revolutionaries gave a press conference. Amin, it was announced, would become foreign minister. And the president of the Revolutionary Council was another ex-student, Mohammed Taraki.
Our relationship with all the countries, including Soviet Union, and all our neighbors and throughout the world will be based depend on the amount of their support to our revolutionary government in political, economical field.
Does this mean, Mr. President, that you will be following the strict policy of non-alignment?
This is quite correct.
The aim of the revolution was to create a new Afghanistan, and parades were held in Kabul to celebrate the radical vision. One of the main aims was to redistribute land fairly, to get rid of a feudal system of landowners and peasants. Every farmer was to be allowed to own their own land, and young revolutionaries from Kabul were filmed going out into the countryside to measure out the new plots. followed by the grateful farmers, kissing their new land certificates. But in reality, the land reforms set the seeds for a bitter conflict in Helmand. It made the divisions that had begun with President Dowd's reforms in the 1960s much worse. As the land was parcelled out, families accused each other of stealing the best bits. And all sorts of hatreds and rivalries were born in Afghan rural society. Rivalries that would set village against village, tribe against tribe. And in Kabul, the revolutionaries started to hate each other too. Hafizullah Amin decided that he should be in charge, and he arranged for his rival Taraki to be killed. Taraki was smothered with a cushion. Amin ordered that anyone who opposed the reforms should be thrown in jail or killed. In Helmand, 100 political prisoners were taken up in a plane and thrown into the giant lake created by the American dam. The Soviet leaders in Moscow became terrified that Afghanistan was falling apart, and they decided to intervene. They rang Amin to tell him that they were sending Russian troops to help his revolution. And at the end of 1979, the troops began to arrive at Kabul airport. What the Russians didn't tell Amin was that the troops were also coming to kill him. The Russians put a sniper on one of the main roads in Kabul, but Amin's convoy drove too fast, and the sniper missed. They tried again. This time they put poison in Amin's can of Pepsi in the presidential palace. But his nephew drank it instead and died. Amin gave a banquet in a palace outside Kabul. The Soviets smuggled in a chef who poisoned the food. This time it worked. All the guests and Amin fell on the floor, writhing in agony. But the Afghan servants rang for help, and two Russian doctors turned up who knew nothing of the plot. They pumped Amin's stomach and he revived. So the Russian troops attacked the palace, threw a grenade at Amin and shot him.
Here the video leaps forwards a few decades to our own time. It shows a riot in Afghanistan. People ransacking what looks like some public buildings. The Americans touched off this riot when they accidentally bombed an Afghan village. Here we must pause Adam Curtis's new documentary, Bitter Lake. More coming next week. And thank you for listening to New World Notes. Find our archive of past shows on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust. Illegitimi non carborundum. Keep the Aspidistra flying, and ciao.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Over the last few months, I participated with a group in organizing six deep state panels for the Left Forum in New York City, May 20th to the 22nd. Over the next few weeks, you'll hear some of the speeches given by our wonderful panelists. Today, it's Barbara Honegger's turn. She participated in a panel called 9/11, An Ecumenical Approach. Barbara is a leading researcher, author, and speaker on the Pentagon and the anthrax letter attacks. She was a White House policy analyst. She was a special assistant to the president. From 2000 to 2011, she was a senior journalist at the Naval Postgraduate School. She's the author of the pioneering book October Surprise on the Iran-Contra scandal, which has now been confirmed by formerly classified documents. She's currently a candidate for the U.S. Congress from California's District 20. She's one of the 50 founding current and former high-level government, military, and intelligence officials to call for a new independent investigation into 9/11. She holds a bachelor's from Stanford University, an MS from John F. Kennedy University, and master's-level certification in national security decision-making from the Naval War College. She's also the creator of the video Behind the Smoke Curtain on what really happened at the Pentagon. So here is part of that speech that she gave at the Left Forum.
Well, thank you, first of all, to the Left Forum for this historic opportunity to bring you the forensic facts of what really happened and what didn't on 9/11 before the largest gathering of progressive activists in this country. We in the 9/11 Truth Movement are genuinely grateful for this opening to the facts and are mindful of the great responsibility that comes with it. And we are honored for this opportunity. For 15 years since 9/11, the leadership of the progressive left in this nation has tried, as we know, unsuccessfully to stop a series of unilateral aggressive wars and occupations overseas. Those wars continue to this day, precisely because the root cause of this evil tree has not been cut. That root is the official claim of who attacked our country on 9/11. That official story is a lie, a gigantic blood libel, which it is my goal in this presentation and Dr. Barrett's to expose for all time so that the 9/11 wars can finally be brought to an end and the real perpetrators finally brought to justice. For make no mistake, the real perpetrators of the attacks on our nation on 9/11, as you will see, are still at large. They are armed and they are extremely dangerous. If it is true that the first casualty of war is the truth, then the first casualty of truth can be war, as it will be when the real facts of September 11th reach a critical mass in our body politic and when the progressive left realizes and acts on the fact that it is the key to achieving that critical mass. This presentation will first and foremost give the evidence. I believe it is absolute proof. I will leave that to your judgment. Will prove that the official 9/11 narrative, the official 9/11 story, upon which all of these ongoing 9/11 wars, on which the transformation of our Defense Department into what is an offense department, with a tripled near-trillion-dollar annual budget, the global domination agenda, and this grotesque surveillance police state we are in, are all based, is completely false. This presentation will then expose the imminent limited hangout, and I will define that in a moment, the imminent limited hangout that is about to be rolled out in Washington, D.C. by the federal government, all of its branches, well, the executive and the legislative branches, to mislead you, the American public, into believing that the, quote, full truth, unquote, of 9/11 will have then finally been told, so that you can then go to sleep and let the offense department continue to do whatever it wants. Now, a limited hangout, very briefly, is when the military intelligence agencies, usually of a country, including our own, have committed an illegal deed, and they are close to being found out. So what they do is they roll out part of the truth in order to try to prevent the media, the Congress, and the people of the country from asking further questions and believing that everything is then known. It's known as a limited hangout in intelligence parlance. So to begin, first, as they say, just the facts, ma'am, and what facts they are. These facts, which you are about to see for yourself, will prove that the real story, both at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon on 9/11, is the same, and that that real story is pre-placed, pre-planted inside the building explosives with plane approaches and impacts as a deceptively engineered to be misperceived but physically impossible cause of the collapses. Inside explosives take weeks, if not months, to pre-place. In New York City, most controlled, high security, controlled access, high security buildings on this entire planet. The Pentagon and the World Trade Center, and especially World Trade Center 7 in New York City, effectively a federal office building because it housed offices of the CIA, the largest CIA office outside of Langley, Virginia, the FBI, the Department of Defense, the SEC, and the Operations Center of the New York Office of Emergency Preparedness, that zero outside terrorists could ever have had the sustained access to plant, because planting pre-placed explosives requires at least weeks in advance of 9/11. So first, let's look at some of the key evidence at the World Trade Center that proves that the official story of 9/11 is a lie. The evidence compiled by the 9/11 Truth Movement about World Trade Centers 1, 2, and 7 is very well known. Both towers were designed specifically to withstand the impact of a large commercial airliner. And no steel frame building, which the towers and all the other buildings in the World Trade Center complex were, have never collapsed due to an impact, fire, or a combination thereof. Not before 9/11, not after, and not on 9/11. That is the official lie. Tall skyscrapers across the world have burned for far longer and far greater fires, even consuming the entire building, and never collapsed, and they never will. It is physically impossible without the pre-planting of explosives. The Twin Towers and World Trade Center 7, the latter not hit by any plane, all three came down in New York City in near free fall speed into effectively their own footprints on 9/11. This is the pattern and signature of classic controlled demolitions with pre-planted explosives. So in New York City on 9/11, two planes effectively brought down three buildings. This is physically impossible. Now we're going to look at slide one. I consider this what I call the most burning data point of all of the World Trade Center events on 9/11 that proves the official story must be a lie, that there is no other possible interpretation. What you are seeing on the screen is a table of the relative times on the morning of 9/11 of a deep basement explosions in both World Trade Centers 1 and 2 before, in both cases, any plane hit the towers, dozens and dozens and dozens of floors higher up in the building. In the case of World Trade Center 2, there was a massive deep basement explosion 17 seconds before the plane hit the building at all. These are facts, and they must be taken into account by the American public, by our media, and by our Congress. These are facts. Now, when you do the math, the official story claims that the planes that impacted the World Trade Centers were going over 500 miles per hour. At that speed, at 14 seconds and 17 seconds before impact on the buildings, Those planes were approximately half a mile from the towers when the deep basement explosions went off. Therefore, it is a necessary inference and therefore a fact that no onboard pilot of either plane could have been in control of the planes when they impacted the towers. Because any pilot in control of either plane could have veered off in that half mile in those 14 and 17 seconds. So whoever planted and triggered the deep basement explosives that went off before either plane hit above in the towers also was in control of the planes on 9/11 to guarantee that the towers would be hit. No hijackers, no pilot, hijacker or otherwise, could therefore have been in control of the planes that hit the Twin Towers on 9/11, even if, as you will see, there were any hijackers on the planes at all. And we know with 100% certainty, 100%, that no hijacker brought down World Trade Center 7, as it was hit by no plane on 9/11, but also came down at about 5:20 p.m. in the early evening of 9/11 in a classic controlled demolition that requires the pre-placement of inside explosives throughout the building weeks, if not months, before 9/11. The official story at the Pentagon, like at the World Trade Center, is explosives. It is pre-placed inside the building explosives and outside the building explosives. Now, it is important for people to know that there was a plane at the Pentagon, but just as at the World Trade Center, the planes were simply the cover cause. They were the deceptively, near simultaneously engineered cover cause for people to believe that the collapses of the World Trade Center towers in the case of New York City and that section of the West Wall of the Pentagon in the case of the Pentagon were caused by the plane impact and fires therefrom. They could not have been, and they were not. Also, at the Pentagon, literally hundreds of witnesses heard bombs go off, said so, have gone on the record, and there was a massive, overwhelming smell of cordite at the Pentagon on 9/11. Cordite is a cool-burning explosive that smells nothing like burning jet fuel. And one of the main witnesses to this overwhelming smell of cordite, and he used that word overwhelming, at the Pentagon was none other than the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff himself, General Hugh Shelton, who said so in his memoirs, used the word overwhelming smell of cordite. So what is the bottom line at the Pentagon? Just as at the World Trade Center, the bottom line of the truth is that no outside terrorist, hijacker or otherwise, Al-Qaeda, bin Laden, or otherwise, no outside terrorist could ever have had the sustained access to either the World Trade Center or the World Trade Center 7 building in New York City that was effectively a government office building, or to the Pentagon before 9/11 to pre-place inside the building explosives that we have proof were pre-planted in all of those buildings. Now, I would like to also refer people to the second link on the screen. It's very important. The first link is to Behind the Smoke Curtain, which is 3 hours of the definitive evidence that the official story at the Pentagon is the same as at the World Trade Center, which is pre-placed inside the building explosives. But it's just about the Pentagon. And also the last third about who did this. The second link is very important. It's the 9/11 Museum virtual walking tour, also on YouTube. And the virtual walking tour is important also because it covers all aspects of 9/11. It covers the World Trade Center. It covers the Pentagon. And it also covers Shanksville, Pennsylvania, and Flight 93. And the wonderful thing about the 9/11 Museum virtual walking tour is that it uses photographs of the actual exhibit items inside the physical 9/11 museum, the official 9/11 museum at Ground Zero, to prove, using their own exhibit items, that the official lie that the museum attempts to cast in stone is a lie. It uses its own exhibit items. And the tour takes you through the museum from beginning to end. And you can actually turn it on with your smartphone and earplugs inside the 9/11 Museum at Ground Zero itself, seven stories underground. I've tested it, and it works. Myself and Bonnie Faulkner of the magnificent Pacifica Radio Network station, KPFA, and her wonderful program for over 15 years, Guns and Butter, she and I are your tour guides in the 9/11 Museum virtual walking tour. And the tour is opened and closed by our wonderful friend and colleague, Bob McElvain, who lost his son, Bobby, at World Trade Center 1 on 9/11. So I highly recommend that everyone watching this presentation go to both of these YouTubes and take the time. It is your duty as a citizen of this great country to know what is in these. Now, briefly, I'm just going to give you some of the top data points about Shanksville on 9/11. The official story claims that Flight 93, with passengers on board, crashed into a field near Shanksville, Pennsylvania. However, that's physically impossible. First off, plane debris from that plane began falling out of the sky 8 miles before Shanksville. The debris field of that plane, like debris fields of the plane that was shot down over Ukraine, it also had a debris field of approximately 8 miles. So, also, one of the engines of the plane that was destroyed over near Shanksville was cut in half, was cut in two, which would not happen except by either a bomb or a missile, almost certainly a missile. The coroner on the scene at the alleged crash site, 8 miles further on in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, said there were simply no bodies there. There was no blood. And also, many people don't realize, you learn this in Behind the Smoke Curtain, that the precise same military plane, a C-130, was at the Pentagon just after the event that caused the big black smoke cloud, which was in a diesel trailer outside the Pentagon, which was the source of what smelled like jet fuel but was actually burning diesel fuel from a diesel fuel trailer. The precise same C-130, U.S. Air Force military aircraft, was at the Pentagon just after this event that caused the big smoke cloud and fire in the diesel trailer outside the Pentagon wall. That same C-130 was then sent to Shanksville, Pennsylvania, where the pilot of that identical C-130 was the first official source for the official story lie claim about what happened at both the Pentagon and Shanksville alleged crash sites. Now, that is not a coincidence. That was pre-planned to roll out the official story, which was a lie from the very get-go on day one. So what is the bottom line of the evidence that you have just seen, and much more in Smoke Curtain and the 9/11 Museum virtual walking tour? The bottom line is that we need to stop thinking of and speaking of 9/11 as a terrorist attack. It was an attack, but it was not a terrorist attack by an outside terrorist of any kind or by the definition of terrorism of any means that the public has been led to believe. 9/11 was not a terrorist attack. It had to have been an inside job. The 9/11 attacks were impossible at an absolute minimum without inside official collaboration, if not orchestration at the Pentagon, and impossible without, at a minimum, collaboration by the owner and lessee of World Trade Center 7, Larry Silverstein, and the other World Trade Center buildings which he leased. He only owned outright World Trade Center 7, which came down in a classic controlled demolition and was not hit by any plane whatsoever. It is impossible without the collaboration by Larry Silverstein and or his building security contractor at the World Trade Center. All right. Now I'm going to move briefly to the second and final part of my presentation, which I call the limited hangout that you are about to experience coming out of official Washington, D.C. And I am talking about what is called the 28 pages, of the Joint House-Senate Intelligence Committee investigation report of 9/11, which was the first of the two official reports. The second one was the 9/11 Commission report by our federal government. And this limited hangout is about these 28 pages and the alleged Saudi connection to 9/11. Now, first, everyone in the 9/11 truth movement, we need to go on record here, does believe that these 28 pages should be declassified and released, despite there being an obvious limited hangout. But when those pages are released, and it now looks like with almost certainty that they will be in the near future, we all need to be fully aware and conscious that the official goal of their release is to try to stop you from asking questions, further questions, that would lead to the real masterminds and perpetrators of the attacks. Now, once this Saudi connection in the 28 pages has been revealed, the real perpetrators hope that the public will assume and buy that the, quote, full story, I underline the word full, of 9/11 will have been then told, and that the victims' family members of the attacks and all the American people and the people of the world can finally have what they call closure. This is the claim that if the 28 pages are released, that there will then be full public knowledge of what happened on 9/11, is actually in the letter that was sent by the co-sponsors of H.R. 14, which is the House side bill calling for President Obama to declassify and release the 28 pages of the Joint House Senate Intelligence Committee 9/11 report. In their own letter to President Obama, they state, quote, we consider this to be a matter of providing the American people with all, underlined all, the facts regarding 9/11 and bringing closure to the many individuals who lost family and friends in those attacks, unquote. And House Resolution H.R. 14 itself states that the declassification and release of the 28 pages is, quote, necessary to provide the American public with the full truth, underline full, of the events of September 11th. But as you have just seen, these 28 pages cannot possibly be anything like the full truth. First, from what has been revealed by members of Congress who have already read the 28 pages, they are only about two of the alleged 19 9/11 hijackers, who, by the way, both happened to have been on the alleged Pentagon plane that you have already seen wasn't anywhere near the Pentagon when pre-planted explosives went off by April Gallup's desk almost 8 minutes earlier, before the official story says the plane even arrived. So information in the 28 pages, when they're revealed finally, about only two of the alleged 19 hijackers, even if this information were true, could not ever be the full truth. Second, at least six and as many as 10 of the alleged 9/11 hijackers, including the Saudi alleged hijackers, were and are still alive. And they went public saying so after the planes they supposedly were in had crashed into flaming fireballs. The 28 pages won't say anything about that. And if the Saudis are sued by the victims' family members, which it looks like they will be, their first line of defense will be, of course, to call the still alive alleged Saudi hijackers into the courtroom. The 28 pages also will not include why the FBI never included Osama bin Laden on its most wanted list for the 9/11 attacks. When asked why not, Rex Toomb, spelled T-O-M-B appropriately, Rex Toomb, who was the chief investigative spokesperson for the FBI, when he was asked why Osama bin Laden wasn't wanted officially by the FBI for 9/11, his public answer was because the FBI doesn't have and didn't have and doesn't have any definitive evidence whatsoever that bin Laden was associated with the attacks. The 28 pages reportedly include mention of Prince Bandar, Saudi Arabia's ambassador to the United States on 9/11, before, during, and after 9/11, who was so close to the Bush family that they, the Bushes, dubbed him Bandar Bush, which they do to this day. The 28 pages won't say anything about how President Bush and this same Prince Bandar Bush celebrated with cigars on the White House balcony shortly after the 9/11 attacks. The 28 pages won't include anything about the Bush White House arranging for those plane loads of Saudi royal family members and even bin Laden family members to leave this country on specially chartered jets before Americans ourselves were allowed to fly. The 28 pages won't say anything about the five dancing Israelis who danced and celebrated the plane impact on the first World Trade Center tower, World Trade Center 1 in New York City, before anyone in the world was supposed to know, except for the alleged hijackers, to know that it was coming. The 28 pages won't say anything about their being arrested, about explosives found in their van, about the lie detector tests they failed, or their being released by dual U.S.-Israeli national Michael Chertoff, who was soon to head our new Homeland Security Department based itself on the official lie of who attacked this country on 9/11, where back in Israel, the five dancing Israelis admitted on Israeli television that they had been sent to the United States to, quote, their words, document the event, unquote. The 28 pages will not say anything about that. The 28 pages will say nothing about the strategic relationship between Israel and Saudi Arabia, or about Prince Bandar Bush meeting with Israel's Mossad intelligence agency and the Israeli military dozens and dozens of times, since beginning at least as early as 1990, over a decade before the attacks of 9/11. The 28 pages will say nothing about Philip Zelikow, the 9/11 Commission Executive Director and co-conspirator with White House National Security Council Director Condoleezza Rice, on behalf of President George W. Bush, who wrote the detailed outline for the official 9/11 story contained in the official 9/11 Commission report before the commission even began its so-called, quote, investigation, unquote. And the 28 pages will not mention that Philip Zelikow, the head of the 9/11 Commission as its executive director, was an expert, according to his own bio, in the, quote, creation and maintenance of public myths. Myth is an official legend. In other words, a lie. Finally, the 28 pages will say nothing about U.S. citizen Anwar al-Awlaki, who, according to the official 911 story, was a key motivator of the very alleged two hijackers mentioned in the 28 pages, who was recently revealed to be a trainer and bomb expert to Al-Qaeda terrorists. It won't mention al-Awlaki having been invited to a special Pentagon luncheon for so-called, quote, moderate, unquote, Muslims in the wake of 9/11, and having given a sermon at the U.S. Capitol, or al-Awlaki having been exposed as an undercover FBI asset. The 28 pages will also say nothing about the self-proclaimed head of ISIS, al-Baghdadi, our alleged enemy, having been recruited by U.S. Army counterterrorism expert and the first medic at Abu Ghraib prison, Gregory Ford, as a United States military informant. Or the fact that when al-Baghdadi was injured on the battlefield, that he was raced to an Israeli hospital where they patched him back to health so they could return him to the battlefield to continue his terrorist acts. According to a recent poll released just April 25th of this year, almost three-quarters, 74% of the American public wants the U.S. government to release everything about the 9/11 attacks, not just this limited hangout of the 28 pages. When these 28 pages, the ultimate limited hangout, are finally released, it will not be the full truth of September 11th, not even close. It will not be the end of the story. It will only be the beginning. It is up to us, the American people, and especially the leadership and top opinion makers of the progressive left, to do everything we can to ensure that the real full story is uncovered, told, and acted upon so that the real perpetrators are finally brought to justice. I thank you for this opportunity to bring the facts to the American people, and to the progressive left leadership, and I look forward to your questions.
That was Barbara Honegger speaking at the Left Forum. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Brian Epps is an African-American activist and executive director of the Malcolm X and Betty Shavaz Memorial and Educational Center. Gil Caldwell is co-executive producer of the newly released film From Selma to Stonewall, Are We There Yet? He's a retired United Methodist minister active in the civil rights movement and a longtime advocate of gay rights. And Sage Services and Advocacy for GLBT Elders. Michael Adams, Sage's CEO, joins us as well for a critical discussion to begin to reclaim the narrative relative to the incredible, almost overwhelming tragedy that occurred in Orlando, where 49 people from the LGBTQ community were shot to death and 53 more wounded. And we'd like to welcome all of you and encourage as much as possible the three of you to really engage each other as we try to wrap our head around what happened and how we should understand it as a society, and what it means then to draw a much broader support for the issues that percolate up from the reality of being LGBTQ within this society. And thank you, all three of you, for joining us. And I want to begin with, indeed, how do we respond to the terrible demagogic exploitation of this tragedy, which was directed against the gay community by the Trumps, if you will, whose brash, explosive politicking insisted he would eliminate the immigration of any Muslim and other individuals from countries he alleges have a history of terrorism. Of course, we know that Omar Mateen, 29, was born and raised in the U.S. There are those who are using this tragedy to launch a broad-based Islamophobic campaign and who seek seriously to curtail our civil rights and freedoms. And that's a heck of a big area to start with, but why don't we give it a chance? And let's begin with Brian. And please, Brian, Gil Caldwell, Michael Adams, really feel free to interchange and discuss this and take the conversation where you think it's important to for our society to learn from it and to respond with a more committed support of the members of the gay community.
I'm sure we'll try to do that.
Yes, it's just a very sad time, of course, and of course, in trying to do justice to those who have been taken from us, it's really difficult to do that. You almost want to take the whole time to just have a moment of silence, right? But just to try to speak to your question, President Obama, his remarks talked about our democratic ideals not being reflected in anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant rhetoric. But the truth is that our traditions and everyday practices are reflected in this rhetoric, right? America has a strong legacy of violence, whether it's attempted genocide of Native American people and the removal, the enslavement of African people, the ongoing Anglo supremacy that exists and that denies immigrants and folks who don't fit a certain narrative in their family legacy, all the rights that they have. And it's almost like we have a tradition of human sacrifice, even though that's like an antiquated idea. That we allow our fellow citizens to die to gun violence all the time. We pay some sort of homage to them momentarily, and then we go back to our regular lives without taking any serious action, right? So our practices and our traditions do reflect strong violence on a daily basis. We're a highly militarized state, and it just seems to fit to me. This anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant rhetoric just seems to fit into what we actually consider should be our daily practice. We have yet to meet our ideals and our principles as stated in the Constitution in terms of treating people with the respect that they deserve and making sure that everybody is treated equally and with love that they're born with.
Well, let me pick up on that. This is Gil Caldwell, and I probably am the oldest member of this trio at 82, civil rights veteran, but I think what you said is important. One of my concerns is that we so easily jump over who were victimized, black and Latino and, of course, white LGBT persons. But, in fact, we simply, I find political leaders and others using that tragedy to simply foster their own other concerns. I think, you know, in light of what you said, the words of James Baldwin, and, of course, many of his words are so important that I find myself here at my advanced age, quoting him, of course, he said, who wants to be integrated into a burning house? But he also talked about going back to where you started from and telling the truth about it. And I think that that's greatly needed at this point because you've identified the hypocrisy and the contradictions. I mean, looking at a nation with all of the verbiage, the creeds, but not the deeds. And I just seem to think that somehow we must find ways to begin again. And, of course, clearly different from the way, of course, Donald Trump is talking about that. But I'd just be interested in how the two of you think about how, in fact, we sort of revisit the beginnings of our nation racially in terms of gay rights, et cetera, to simply acknowledge our contradictions. And as you've suggested, that we simply are not following our principles, our verbal principles, in the way we respond.
Well, you know, I think to respond in part to that and add to Brian and Gil's comments, one of the strengths that comes from the work that an organization like SAGE does in working with our elders and elders in our community is a perspective that's grounded in history, including LGBTQ history. And when we look at our history, we know that the attack in Orlando is vicious and horrible and brutal as it is far from unique. And in fact, our places where we gather are places where we have found safety and strength as a community have repeatedly been attacked decade after decade after decade by many different kinds of people with many different belief systems, some of whom have been fundamentalist Christians, some of whom have been people from many different kinds of beliefs. And it has always been, I believe, a profound mistake to try to focus on and try to discern the ideology or the motivation of one single attacker, when that's not what this is about. That's not what this is about at all. This is about systemic homophobia in our society, systemic transphobia in our society. And when we realize, again, you know, to points that we just made, who was targeted in this particular case, and we're talking about LGBT folks who are people of color, who are Latino, who are black, we're looking at a systemic problem, and we have to be vigilant as a community not to allow this tragedy to be hijacked by those who would attack us and who would try to turn us against each other, because frankly that just cheapens the lives of the people whose lives were lost here. And I have been happy to see really many folks in the LGBTQ community being vigilant from the beginning about this, because sadly it was completely predictable that Trump and the people around him were going to try to utilize this for their nefarious goals.
I would add systemic racism to that, of course, and I'm sure you would include that.
Yes, absolutely.
I think one of the things I, as a clergy person, a United Methodist clergy person, clearly want to identify what you said in terms of the faith-based groups. One of my great concerns, of course, is that how, in fact, we have misused our scriptures. I reach into my own scriptures and talk about how in the Hebrew Bible, people have picked up Noah's curse, the curse of Ham, as justification for the subjugation of black people. And I suggest that we've also, those of us who have not become enlightened in our denominations, have a curse against LGBT people. And so I think that's important. And I think it's important to hold the religious community, we've got to hold the religious community responsible. I was interested, the New York Times talks about Georgetown University, of course, and its history of selling slaves in order to deal with debt. But there's an interesting picture of one of the persons who was a part of that slave family, that history, meeting with the president, and they are attempting to deal with that. I am hopeful that as I continue to be pleased with my own university, Boston University, I am a graduate of the School of Theology, that it will continue to do some of the significant things it's doing in terms of overcoming racism, overcoming heterosexism. So I think as you identify history, it seems to me that universities with their various departments have a real responsibility to sort of dig deep and look at this history that has brought us to this sad moment.
Brian?
I definitely agree with both of you. You both raised very valid points. I think part of why I enjoy the work that I do at the Malcolm X Memorial is because I believe that we don't memorialize and or celebrate these values enough. If freedom is our principle and is our value, we don't really celebrate that enough in a very truthful way, right? And so in memorializing Malcolm X, we're memorializing a legacy of social justice and human rights, right? And that's not something that we do very often here in this country, and I think that's part of why we miss the point on our practices on a daily basis, right? And so we have this violence occurring all over our country, all over the place, right? And the second point into being that in terms of our faith and looking at sacred texts, so many folks want to honor the text, want to honor their religions, but we have to first talk about how these sacred texts are promoting the things that we don't value, homophobia, sexism. The appreciation for genocide is all over the sacred text, right? So we have to look at the text and say, yes, they are sacred, but yes, we also have to realign our values to not celebrate the exception for slavery, for all of the other things that are mentioned in the text as well. So I think that this has to become part of our daily practice. It has to be something that we have to agree on as a community, and we have to move forward from that.
Could I just add, in terms of talking about this text, that one of the things, of course, about the Hebrew Bible, Marcus Borg, now no longer with us, that he wonders, why is it that people pick up the anti-gay kinds of things in Scripture and don't look at what the Hebrew Bible says about the economy, a year of Jubilee, et cetera, and the whole matter of dealing with economics? Would it not be wonderful if people across the continuums could use their faith traditions and other traditions to deal with the economic conditions that are ours, and how, in fact, we have not dealt as seriously with that as we've dealt with somehow acting out our phobias against persons, and I'm hoping that will happen. How does that sound to the two of you?
Well, if I may also just intervene in one sense, Michael, I was particularly thinking as you spoke that while there are 49 dead here and more than 53 wounded, I was reminded of the 32 people that were killed in the 1973 fire at the upstairs lounge in the French Quarter in New Orleans, which until now was the largest death toll in an attack on a gay gathering place in the United States, and should say that Pulse, similarly, was a shrine, in fact. It was a gathering place, such as Stonewall was, such as the church was in South Carolina,
yes,
where
awesome, yes.
The people were,
yes,
killed. So the culture of bigotry and of violence against the LGBTQ community really courses through the DNA, the bloodstream historically of our society. And I think that is something that is, this is looked at with a certain singularity by the mass media and not at all as part of a systemic reality that our gay and lesbian, transgendered sisters and brothers have faced and are facing.
That is absolutely right, and I think that is key. That as horrific as what happened in Orlando is, it is not singular. It is not singular, and it must be seen in its larger context. And I think it is so appropriate to raise and remember what happened in the upstairs lounge, which was the loss of 32 lives in an incredibly, incredibly vicious attack. The upstairs lounge was on the second story in a building, and the attackers poured gasoline all up and down the stairs leading from the ground floor to the second floor, locked the door to the second floor, and then lit the whole place on fire, and the people inside were incinerated. And in 1973... Nothing in any way meaningful was done to investigate that attack. Nobody was brought to justice, so to speak. And sadly, the families of many of those who died inside were never even turned out to collect the remains of their loved ones, because of the stigma and the bigotry that existed within our own families against LGBTQ people. And in some ways, I think that points as well to some of the progress that we are making and some of the rays of hope here. One of the things that has been really moving to see has been the embracing and loving and supportive response of so many family members of those who were lost. And I want to point out that part of the racism we see in our society now in the LGBTQ context is this caricature of people of color communities as though somehow they remain the unique centers of homophobia while white communities have become more enlightened. We all know that that is not true. And to see Latino and African-American families turning out and embracing and lifting up those young folks, predominantly young folks, who were killed in Orlando, I think is a sign of tremendous progress, as is the fact that many of the first community-based vigils and speaking outs that have been organized have been interfaith vigils, lifting up a great variety of faith perspectives, including, I might add, perspectives from queer Muslim activists. And one of the things that has been extremely heartening for me has been to see the leadership of queer Muslim activists, including Sadia Abjani, who is a training specialist at SAGE and has really been a profoundly important voice. So in the midst of this horrible tragedy, we must remember the history, the systemic aspects of, and also we are, in fact, making progress in the midst of these horrors, which I think is important to know.
Do you think that Orlando could help us break through this silo mentality which in fact I think I speak now as a civil rights veteran, that sometimes I think our movement was a kind of a silo-like kind of thing that did not engage in intersectionalities. That's why the film that I'm involved in is talking about intersections. But is there a possibility that Orlando and all related to that can be a significant breakthrough for all of us, for the nation, in terms of beginning to see the similarities? Remember, Martin Luther King said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Do you think that Orlando could help us begin to do that in ways that we've not done it before, to understand that interconnection?
Well, one thought in that regard that it still sticks with me. One of the very first telephone calls that I received after the news of Orlando broke was from Dr. Yanira Cruz, who is the head of the National Hispanic Council on Aging. SAGE works closely with the National Hispanic Council on a variety of issues. And it was Dr. Cruz who was actually the very first person who reached me and said, these are our people. These are Latino LGBTQ people who have been slaughtered. And we must join arms and work together. And Dr. Cruz and I issued a statement and been working together in the days since. I think it's just that's one small example of how there is a great opportunity to break down the silos here and to continue to build the bridges in our community. Fortunately, some of that work has been happening, but a tragedy like this creates the dire need to lift that up. And I think we're seeing some of that in the early days, and we have to make sure that it continues and that we don't allow ourselves to be pitted against each other by the Trumps of the world.
I think we really are at this breaking point, right, where you have Trump really talking about what has been our tradition of violence, right, and trying to make that part of our everyday political process, right? And so we're at the point where folks are actually going to make a decision between our principles going to match our actions or are they not, right? And I think this is really what the election is about, and is really what this overall debate about. There's also, I mean, there's a lot of people who are coming in support of those who we've lost and who were taken from us. There's also a lot of silence, I noticed, especially on social media, of folks not speaking out against this injustice, and different organizations not helping, right? So I'm hopeful, but also very concerned in terms of our collective ability to respond to injustice, to really try to match our principles that we discussed earlier.
My hope is that that as we reflect, that we can learn much from some of the issues that surfaced with the Obama presidency in terms of resistance to that, a party saying no, and the rise of Trump. It seems to me that that says something about where we are and what we need to respond to. We've learned a lot about ourselves as a nation in response to the Obama candidacy, and now we're learning a lot about ourselves as there is the Trump ascendancy. It just seems to me that should serve as a kind of directive for what we must do with greater vigor as we move into the future.
You know, absolutely. I would say, you know, the rise of Trump and the hatred and bigotry and sense of violence that has surrounded him, if that is not a call to action for progressives and individuals and communities that are committed to social justice, I don't know what is. It seems to me that in a sense, to have this kind of a tragedy that brings together homophobia and transphobia and racism happen in the midst of Trump's campaigns. There's a reason why these things are happening together, because these are really a slap in the face to those of us who know that we have got to redirect the course of our society toward progressive values of inclusion and justice, which is the antithesis of what the hatred and bigotry of Trump is.
I want to give, as time races on, and we want to continue to cover this from a number of different perspectives throughout the course of our program, I want to give each one of you, if you would be so kind as to perhaps a minute is hardly sufficient, but if you would rise to the occasion and each one perhaps a final thought on where we go from here most explicitly. And I have to say that what was looming large in my mind as most critical was that while the I believe politically that whether this assassin was inspired by some extremist manifestation of religion, the reality is that his specific motivation to inflict the utmost violence was perpetrated upon the LGBTQ community, and in this instance, a community who was predominantly Latino. And those really are the threshold issues that must be the takeaway from here. So perhaps why don't we do a go around with Brian Epps and then hear from Gil Caldwell and Michael Adams. And I really want to thank all of you for the discourse this morning and the contribution thus far.
Thank you, Mimi, and thank you to the fellow panelists. I think there's two parts to this. Again, I'm looking just at our state as a whole and our overall militarization. If the Second Amendment exists to protect citizens from the state, then we have to look at the state itself and look at the violence that we're perpetrating as a nation and look at how that's completely unacceptable to our daily existence. There's also this piece of religion, I believe, and just our overall values. You know, folks like Malcolm X used their religion to be progressive and to try to advocate human rights and social justice, not to conserve all of the negative values that exist in our society. And I think that's just how we need to look at ourselves and our own religiosity and our own philosophies and theologies going forward. And, of course, we have to embrace the fullness of who we are as a nation, that includes folks of color, that includes our LGBTQ community, that includes everybody who's marginalized, such as immigrants, legal or not, and everybody else, right? And so we have to do these two things in order to move forward in safety and in love.
I'm pleased that we are hearing the name Malcolm X. One of my favorite pictures is that of Malcolm X, of course, meeting Martin Luther King. Martin King's last book was titled "Where Do We Go From Here: Chaos or Community?" And it seems to me that the civil rights movement was far from perfect as a participant in it. And I'm hoping that my two panelists, in terms of the kinds of things that they have been about and will be about, that one will not attempt to replicate, but simply piece together what we tried to do back in the day to the kinds of things that you're doing now. And it just seems to me that that clearly shapes what the future ought to be like.
So when I hear Malcolm X, James Baldwin, as we've talked about here, we're talking about our elders. We're talking about those who have come before us and paved the way for the world that we're trying to build. And I think that's a very powerful, these are very powerful points of reference at a time when we're talking about a tragedy that took the lives of so many young LGBTQ people of color. It is to bring together the wisdom, the experience, and the deep roots of our elders with our young folks, our young people of color, and to really make this an intergenerational movement, as well as a movement across races and across faiths, I think is critically important. And again, I think it's one of the opportunities that can emerge from something as horrible as this.
Michael Adams, CEO of SAGE. Brian Epps, African-American activist, executive director of the Malcolm X and Betty Shabazz Memorial and Educational Center. Gil Caldwell, co-executive producer of the newly released film, which we'll talk more about in another program. You really must see it. It's very important, and even more so in this context. From Selma to Stonewall, are we there yet? Thank you for your insightful and loving and informative words in the midst of this terrible, terrible tragedy. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
This is a sobering reminder that attacks on any American, regardless of race, ethnicity, religion, or sexual orientation, is an attack on all of us.
Love is love is love is love is love.
It's time to internationalize our LGBTI movements and say, what's happening in Uganda affects me. What's happening in Indonesia is part of my understanding of a queer community.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappelle. LGBTs slaughtered in ISIS-inspired Orlando massacre. Russia leads the elimination of queers from UN HIV/AIDS resolution. And Western activists gain insight into international strategies. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Michelle Marie Gilgeson.
And I'm Carol Myers.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending June 11th, 2016. Russia led an effort at the United Nations this week to strip language that included the decriminalization of homosexuality and drug use from a resolution at a major gathering that called for ending the HIV/AIDS pandemic by 2030. Iran, Poland, and several Gulf states joined in to block the decriminalization language in the resolution adopted by the UN General Assembly on June 8. Russian health official Dilyara Rabilova-Borovik argued that governments have a sovereign right to decide their own public health strategy. The Vatican also voiced its opposition to the more explicit language in the resolution that identified sex workers and gay men as at-risk groups. What's being called a high-level meeting on ending AIDS has drawn medical experts and government officials from across the world to UN headquarters in New York. It's already been marked by controversy when the 51-member nation Organization of Islamic Cooperation succeeded in blocking a number of LGBT activist groups, most from Africa or the Middle East, from attending. Russia also offered a resolution that could have allowed it and other countries with anti-LGBT laws to deny antiviral treatment to gay men. That proposal failed. However, according to a June 9th report by BuzzFeed's J. Lester Fetter, a group of five South American countries will soon propose a new position at the UN to investigate human rights violations against LGBTI people. Such a special rapporteur would answer to the United Nations Human Rights Council, which begins its new session in Geneva next week.
Another leading LGBT activist has been brutally murdered. This time, it was 39-year-old Rene Martinez of Honduras. He was reportedly forced into a vehicle as he was arriving home from work on June 1st. The Associated Press reported that his body was found 2 days later and that the cause of death was strangulation. Martinez led the San Pedro Sula-based rights group Comunidad Gay Sembradana, and like the Bangladeshi activist who was also viciously murdered last month, he worked with the U.S. Agency for International Development. A statement issued by the U.S. Embassy on behalf of the people and government of the United States condemned in the strongest terms the apparent murder of Rene Martinez, calling him a leader in the LGBTI community in San Pedro Sula and a rising political figure in Honduras. In fact, La Prensa reported that Martinez was already a well-known member of the country's governing national party. At last report, investigators had yet to identify potential suspects. Anti-LGBT violence and discrimination are commonplace in the Central American country.
But Singapore's 8th Pink Dot Festival was so successful this year that the government has decided to crack down on the LGBT event's foreign corporate sponsors. The Ministry of Home Affairs said in a June 8th statement that foreign entities should not fund, support, or influence events held at Speaker's Corner, the part of Hong Lim Park that hosts Pink Dot. It's the only free speech area in the city-state where peaceful gatherings are allowed without a permit. This year's Pink Dot on June 8th had 18 corporate sponsors, twice last year's total. The majority were foreign conglomerates and included Facebook, Google, Apple, Barclays, JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, General Electric, BP, Bloomberg, and Twitter. Attendees were treated to a Pink Dot concert this year, featuring homegrown talents like pop soul artist Gareth Fernandez and a cappella group Mi Cappella. TV host and writer Anita Kapoor, local comedian Leo Ling Ling, and hip-hop artist Suga Shay also rallied the crowd. The event culminated with the tens of thousands of people who overflowed the park, raising their pink placards simultaneously to underscore the theme of the event, Freedom to Love. This year's crowd exceeded the estimated 28,000 people who were at the 2015 edition. As for the threatened government crackdown, Pink Dot organizers said that the event's corporate sponsors are all registered and incorporated in Singapore. "We are fortunate to count among them," their statement read, "admired household names, employers of choice for a sizable portion of our workforce, inextricably linked with and fully a part of this beautiful fabric we call home." If the government presses its case, the annual Pink Dot Festival could be even more newsworthy next year.
In other news, the Irish Presbyterian Church, the largest Protestant denomination in both the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland, has ordered its ministers to read a statement opposing marriage equality at every heterosexual wedding ceremony from now on. While activists continue to battle the government of Northern Ireland for marriage rights, gay and lesbian weddings began in the Republic of Ireland late last year after a public vote overwhelmingly approved them. The statement that's now required reading at all Irish Presbyterian Church weddings says that, "Since the beginning of creation, God, in his gracious purpose, provided marriage as the accepted way in which a man and a woman may come together as husband and wife. This is the only basis on which marriage can take place within the Presbyterian Church in Ireland. Since the Church operates across both the Republic and Northern Ireland, the statement is now mandatory in Northern Ireland too, even though civil marriage is not yet legal there for lesbian and gay couples. There is no record of any religious institution that opposes same-gender unions ever being forced to officiate them in countries that have civil marriage equality, so it's not clear what the Church hopes to accomplish. Nevertheless, the clerk of its General Assembly, Reverend Trevor Gribben, told reporters that the new wedding vow would help protect freedom of religious practice."
The daughter of South Africa's iconic civil rights activist and Nobel Peace Prize winner Desmond Tutu, also a longtime vocal advocate for LGBT rights, has been virtually kicked out of the country's Anglican church for marrying a woman. Umpho Tutu Van Firth married her longtime girlfriend, Marceline Van Firth, in a December ceremony in the Netherlands. Like her father, who reportedly gave his blessing, Umpho is an Anglican cleric. She told local media that the Bishop of Cape Town, who'd originally allowed her to officiate in his diocese, was told to revoke her license after officials found out about the wedding. Umpho said she decided to return her license in late May rather than wait for it to be taken. South Africa enacted marriage equality in 2006, but the Anglican Church continues to be sharply divided by the issue. The Episcopal Church, the U.S. branch of the worldwide Global Anglican Communion, supports marriage equality, for which it has been punished because most Anglican churches in Latin America, Asia, and Africa, known as the Global South, are staunchly opposed. Tutu Van Firth remains a priest in good standing in the U.S., where she was ordained.
Ratcheting up the debate on transgender bathroom use in the U.S., Virginia's Gloucester County School Board, as expected, announced on June 7th that it would appeal to the Supreme Court the late-May decision of the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals that overturned its policy requiring transgender students to use separate unisex bathrooms and locker rooms rather than the boys or girls facilities that match their gender identity. The case of 16-year-old transgender student Gavin Grimm has already reached landmark status. If the High Court agrees to hear the school board's appeal, which likely won't be until sometime in 2017, it would be the first time that the justices had decided to consider a case involving transgender rights. If the Supreme Court refuses to hear the case, or if they do and the current 8 justices split 4-4, the Fourth Circuit ruling will be considered definitive not only for Virginia, but for all the other states in the circuit, West Virginia, Maryland, South Carolina, and North Carolina. At least 5 federal lawsuits are pending against North Carolina's infamous HB2, which requires trans students to use the sex-segregated public facilities that match what's on their birth certificate rather than their gender identity.
And finally, North Carolina Republican Representative Dan Bishop of Mecklenburg, who wrote HB2, continues to reject any effort to repeal it. It's important to note that while the focus has been on bathrooms, the law also bans local governments from protecting their LGBT citizens from discrimination. "I don't fear man, I fear God," he wrote to a constituent, "so I won't be backing down." Responding to a supporter who compared opponents of HB2 to the Taliban, Bishop wrote, "I love that idea," and that the LGBT movement jeopardizes freedom. However, he'll apparently need to count country music star Dolly Parton among the Taliban. The credits of the longtime LGBT rights ally include writing and performing the Oscar-nominated song "Travelin' Through" for the 2005 Felicity Huffman starring Trans America. Parton dispatched the so-called bathrooms issue in just 16 seconds during an interview this week on CNN Money.
"I think everybody should be treated with respect. I don't judge people. I try not to get too caught up in all the controversy of things. I hope that everybody gets a chance to be who and what they are. I just know if I have to pee, I'm going to pee. I don't care where it's going to be."
That's News Wrap for the week ending June 11th, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michelle Marie Gilkison.
And I'm Carol Myers.
Today we're dealing with something that we never imagined and is unimaginable.
Orlando, Florida Mayor Buddy Dyer.
"And it is with great sadness that I share we have 50 casualties. There are another 53 that are hospitalized."
An LGBT bar in Orlando, Florida was the target of a homophobic, ISIS-inspired attack in the wee hours of June 12th, the deadliest mass shooting in modern U.S. history. 50 people were murdered and 53 wounded in the horrific slaughter at the Pulse nightclub, but officials say the death toll is likely to rise. President Barack Obama called the massacre an act of terror and an act of hate.
"This is an especially heartbreaking day for all of our friends, our fellow Americans who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. The shooter targeted a nightclub where people came together to be with friends, to dance and to sing and to live. The place where they were attacked is more than a nightclub. It is a place of solidarity and empowerment where people have come together to raise awareness, to speak their minds, and to advocate for their civil rights. So this is a sobering reminder that attacks on any American, regardless of race, ethnicity, religion, or sexual orientation, is an attack on all of us and on the fundamental values of equality and dignity that define us as a country. And no act of hate or terror will ever change who we are or the values that make us Americans."
The shooter has been identified as 29-year-old Omar Mateen, a U.S.-born security guard whose parents emigrated from Afghanistan. He reportedly had expressed outrage at the sight of public homosexuality, and in a phone call to a police emergency dispatcher during the attack, he pledged allegiance to the Islamic State. Numbing shock spread throughout the community, as described by the Reverend Elder Nancy Wilson, general moderator of Metropolitan Community Churches.
"I'm the global leader of MCC churches around the world, and our church was founded with a special outreach to LGBT people, their friends and families, and we're heartbroken and we're in shock that 50 members of our community and people, at young people at a nightclub having a good time, were just mowed down in this way. And we know now that this was definitely a hate crime, which always proceeds from fear, and that even though we've made progress in our country and the world with marriage equality and other things, there is a backlash. There is a deep level of fear still among people. And our community has experienced violence and oppression and before, but this is of such a scale that I think we can't take it in yet."
The investigation continues, and This Way Out will have a full report on the Pulse massacre next week. Meanwhile, security precautions are being intensified for upcoming Pride celebrations in this season of Stonewall. Impromptu memorial demonstrations are taking place around the country, and supporters from around the world are expressing their condolences. One powerful message of grief and resistance came from Hamilton composer Lin-Manuel Miranda in his Best Score acceptance speech at Broadway's Tony Awards.
When senseless acts of tragedy remind us that nothing here is promised, we live through times when hate and fear seem stronger. We rise and fall and light from dying embers, remembrances that hope and love last longer. And love is 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 love cannot be killed or swept aside. I sing Vanessa's symphony. Eliza tells her story. Now fill the world with music, love, and pride. Thank you so much for this.
Hello, I am Dennis Shepherd, Matthew Shepherd's father, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities.
How can Western activists work most effectively to promote LGBT rights around the world? This Way Out's Abby Dees and Wenzel Jones got a lesson in international human rights from Outright International Executive Director Jessica Stern. It should be noted that this interview took place before the Pulse massacre shattered the illusion of security for LGBT people in the United States.
Just before we came on air, I asked you, what do you want to talk about? You said pride. It's Pride Month.
Because I think it's really important that LGBTI people in the U.S. send a message that a gay marriage decision by the U.S. Supreme Court does not represent the sum total of our movement's agenda, that our agenda is actually one of liberation. And the work has to go on, whether it's a fight for access to bathrooms that is fundamentally based on dignity, or we want to take on the growing inequalities experienced by queer youth, people of color, and other vulnerable Americans. But the second part of the story is that I think as we become safer in the U.S., it's time to internationalize our analysis as LGBTI movements and say, what's happening in Uganda affects me. What's happening in Nigeria is part of my understanding of a queer community, and I want to know how I can give back.
I'm glad you mentioned the bathroom bills, because I think a lot of people could very sort of facilely say, gosh, here we are in America, we're arguing about, you know, bathrooms, and people are being stoned to death for being gay in other places. Where are our priorities? Are our issues the same?
Are our issues the same as LGBTI people around the world?
Yeah.
I think your question in many ways hits the nail on the head. What experiences are universal when ultimately desire is so personal?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I would say the universal dimensions of our struggle are safety, full recognition under the law, dignity. I mean, these things, they look very different depending upon where you live. You know, our family structures vary radically from country to country. But the fact that we want to be accepted by our families and we want the right to form our own families is probably a universal experience. I work for Outright International, and what we really do is we partner with local community-based organizations around the world, and they have their networks and they know how to talk to people within their communities. And then they turn to us and they say, what are some of the ways we can campaign more effectively? How do we actually get some part of the government to talk with us? And then we come in and we basically do a situational analysis and we say, what are your strengths? What are your challenges? And here are some ideas for how to move forward. And I think this is important as a lot of Americans are thinking beyond U.S. borders. The idea is not to export what we've done in the United States. You can't export our successes and our failures. That will never work somewhere else. But what you can say are, these are some of the tools in the toolbox. See what works for you and leave the rest behind.
What region of the world would you say the LGBT community is most successfully woven into the fabric of the society at large?
You know, it's very hard to answer in one way because integration looks different everywhere. So for instance, I think that in Latin America, LGBTI movements have been very much integrated into broader human rights movements. And part of the reason why we've seen almost lightning successes in the past 10 years is because LGBTI activists were so woven into the fabric of struggles post-dictatorship for other communities' rights as well as for their own rights, that when they started to say, we're ready to actually advocate for this specific category of LGBTI recognition, people said, of course, you've been with us all along. We're going to be there for you. Some of the strongest activists that I know are from the Middle East, and they stand up on every progressive issue. I feel like their analysis of intersectionality is like mind-bogglingly sophisticated. They definitely are not just asking for gay rights. They're asking for human rights for everyone.
One place you did want to talk about, I know, was Indonesia.
Yeah, thank you so much for asking about it. I thought maybe your listeners would have read a little bit about the crisis that unfolded in Indonesia in the first quarter of this year. A minister of education heard that there was a kind of student organization working on sexuality on a university campus. He got wind of this. He wanted to shut down the organization. He accused it of being a gay activist organization, which in fact it wasn't. And his scapegoating of this one organization just spread like wildfire across the country. Cabinet minister after cabinet minister almost tried to outdo one another in hateful statements. And then members of parliament jumped on the bandwagon. And many of those members of parliament also own the major media outlets in the country. So then it became the, you know, tabloid news story of the day. It got to the point where there actually was a successful initiative to ban gay emojis. Let that sink in.
Not quite sure what they look like.
They seem about as sexless as anything could be.
And yet totally threatening in what they symbolize. And actually, Outright and two Indonesian organizations, particularly this one group, Aris Pelangi, an LGBTI group, we're holding a training for community members looking at, you know, how to be safe, how to access citizenship rights. And a right-wing fundamentalist organization found out where the meeting was. They showed up at the hotel. They threatened the hotel management. They said the meeting had to be shut down. Our colleagues contacted the police and said, we feel unsafe. We have a contract with the hotel. We want to carry out our business. And the police said, you need to work this problem out with the fundamentalist group directly. I wanted to bring this up because I think Indonesia is actually the place I've seen in recent years where there's been a moral panic that spread faster than anywhere else, faster than Russia, faster than Uganda. And yet the story really hasn't made its way to most people's consciousness.
What do you think it is about Indonesia specifically that made that such a hotspot?
There are as many theories as to why the moral panic spread so quickly in Indonesia as there are potentially right answers. Mm-hmm. But I think it's important to look at the situation in context. There's more than 120 LGBTI organizations in Indonesia. Indonesia is the world's fourth most populous country. It's the world's largest Muslim country. So it is a fascinating and incredibly important place when you're talking about LGBTI acceptance. One of the main theories about why this moral panic spread so quickly is that the government is really he doesn't have a majority power. He's looking to curry power with the political base, and he's grasping at straws. And what I wanted to make sure your listeners were aware of is that there's a national security bill making its way through the Indonesian parliament, and it's written really broadly, and it's going to be used to crack down on LGBTI activism and human rights defenders if the definition isn't narrowed. And I think this is a problem both in the context of Indonesia, but also because the linking of LGBTI rights and threats to national security is something that we all have to be very afraid of.
And I'm just curious, to bring it back down to home, what would your mid-semester report card be for America right now?
In terms of LGBTI U.S. foreign policy, I would give it like an A.
Really?
And yeah, I'm almost embarrassed to say that, but yeah, I would.
How so?
Well, you can never divorce LGBTI rights from the U.S.'s larger strategies around militarism and human rights on other issues. But I am trying to do that anyway. And I would say the U.S. government has more successfully developed policies and mainstreamed them throughout the work of the State Department and USAID.
And may we continue to be doing that. For folks who do want to make a difference, I think it's so easy to say, I'm worried about what's happening in Indonesia or Uganda or Iran. What can we do?
Two things. Make sure that when you're voting in the next presidential election, foreign policy is a part of your priorities and your calculations. The U.S. actually has been a leading voice on the international stage for LGBTI rights, and it's made a huge and positive difference. That's one thing. And a second thing is, I hate to say it, but make donations.
Yeah.
Make donations to support community-based organizations, including Outright.
And if we wanted to donate to Outright, where would we go?
Oh my God, I'm so glad you asked. You could go to a lovely website that we newly designed to make very fabulous and accessible.
I noticed it looks cool.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yes.
And it's outrightinternational.org.
Outright International Executive Director Jessica Stern was interviewed by Abby Dees and Wenzel Jones. And finally, a snippet from The Late Show with Stephen Colbert on CBS lets us end on a lighter note this week. Colbert is fond of poking fun at the record of one six-term East Texas congressman, arguably the most ignorant and most homophobic member of the U.S. House of Representatives. The man who's been described as an accomplished idiot just handed Colbert another straight line.
A few lingering issues of intolerance left in the United States of America, but there's one bright spot out there, and that's gay rights. In just a few short years, we've seen legalized same-sex marriage, the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and the mainstream acceptance of brunch. But not everyone has been won over. Take Texas Congressman Louis Gohmert. Recently, on the floor of Congress, Gohmert tackled the pressing issue of gays in space.
You're wanting to save humankind for posterity. Basically a modern day Noah. Okay, we've got a spaceship that can go as Matt Damon did in the movie, plant a colony somewhere. If you could decide what 40 people you put on the spacecraft that would save humanity, how many of those would be same-sex couples?
Oh, I know that one. I know that one. Yes, I looked it up in the Bible. This is true. There were actually only 8 people on Noah's Ark, and they repopulated the entire world, which means, by his own logic, the remaining 32 people on Louis Gohmert's space ark could be gay, gay, gay. And if that happened only 2 years after it launched, that spaceship would be the most expensive neighborhood in the galaxy.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Michelle Marie Gilkison, Carol Myers, and Abby Dees and Wenzel Jones contributed program material, with thanks, as always, to Steve Pride. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. You'll find more information about the show, the crew, a video teaser for our must-have LGBT History from Outlaws to In-Laws CD, and more at thiswayout.org. Email TWORadio@AOL.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on CFRC Kingston, Ontario, WPSU and WPSB, University Park and Kane, Pennsylvania, KKFI Kansas City, Missouri, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all, stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. When I say border zone, maybe you think of checkpoints and fences and walls. In other words, you think of land borders along which people sometimes die trying to move from one nation to another. But maritime borders also exist with their own set of perils. And when boats capsize and migrants drown, we're tempted to attribute their deaths to the elements, to waves and water and wind, or to smugglers whose ships are sometimes built to fall apart. Today, the focus is on the Mediterranean Sea, across which more than a million people have recently traveled from locations in North Africa to the shores of Greece and Italy. The mass suffering and dying in the Mediterranean and the Aegean Sea has spurred humanitarian efforts and provoked statements of compassion and concern, but none of that is enough for Maurice Stierl, who has been researching and writing about migration struggles in the Mediterranean, and who is now visiting assistant professor at the University of California, Davis. The crisis, he has written, is a product of intensified border militarization by the nations of Europe that is shamelessly sold as a humanitarian rescue mission. We may view seaborne travelers to Europe as desperate, helpless victims, but they are also, Maurice Stierl argues, people engaged in political struggles that need to be acknowledged and supported. Maurice isn't just a scholar. He is active with, among other things, a hotline that responds to distress calls from migrant vessels in the Mediterranean. When I spoke recently with Maurice Stierl in our KPFA Berkeley studios, I asked him how many people have died or disappeared in the Mediterranean while attempting to travel to Europe over the last several years.
In the past few years, the level of death or the number of deaths has steadily increased. Up to today, this year, we have more than 2,600 deaths in the Mediterranean. Last year, we had more than 3,700. And so it has steadily increased, especially since the Arab uprisings. And the death toll over the last few decades, you know, some say it's more than 20,000 people.
And remind us where these people are coming from in general.
So it also really depends, obviously, on the different conflicts that we are seeing in the different regions. But we have very big communities from Afghanistan, from Eritrea, from Iraq, and of course from Syria now.
And you gave me such a large number of deaths, and we're going to talk about what causes these deaths in some detail over the course of the hour. But is it at all fair to say that the Mediterranean Sea, that sea conditions are such that it would be difficult, or that it is difficult, for boats of a certain quality to make a successful crossing?
Yes, definitely. And we can also see that the, you know, fabric, the kind of materialities of these boats have changed over the past few years. And in many ways, this also goes together with the different interventions at sea. So, for example, a lot of boats that leave from Libya are not really intended to actually make it to, say, Lampedusa, right? Because now the presumption is that people would be picked up off the Libyan waters or outside the Libyan waters by, say, private rescue agencies, by obviously state rescue agencies or cargo vessels. So the boats become worse and worse, and obviously then the risk attached to that grow.
And what's been the response of European authorities to this loss of life in the Mediterranean Sea?
So I think what we can see now is also, again, a shift, right? So in the past few years, we've had thousands of deaths every year. So and back then, especially after the large shipwrecks of 2013 and October 2013 and the large shipwrecks of April 2015 in particular, we had responses ranging from humanitarian gestures to novel forms of deterrence. What I find really disconcerting now is that the narrative has become a narrative of silence in many ways, right? We have seen many shipwrecks over the past few days and weeks, and there has been hardly any reaction from state authorities.
Well, one big piece of news was when the EU earlier this year agreed to a deal with Turkey. It was part of an effort to keep people from traveling by boat from Turkey to Greece. Can you talk about that?
So the EU-Turkey deal falls into patterns that have emerged over the past few years where the European Union is trying to externalize its borders. What I mean by that is that other countries are now doing Europe's border work in terms of deterring migrants or, you know, imprisoning migrants so that they would not leave and move further towards Europe.
Right. And here we really have to bring up the concern in Europe among governments and authorities and many people that the continent will be overrun by people from the Middle East, from Northern Africa. How strong is that sentiment, and where does EU policy stand in relation to deterrence, maybe as compared with even last year?
Okay, so they obviously would not call it deterrence policies. They also quite often tend to wrap it in humanitarian narratives. Usually the idea of preventing deaths at sea is being used to argue for these new arrangements. So EU policy leaders say that fewer people will take to the sea, which means that there will be fewer deaths, and of course then our policy has worked. In reality, people are basically imprisoned in places they want to escape, such as Turkey, Libya, and very recently now the EU Commission has proposed to also have a similar kind of model apply to other states, especially African states, which would imprison further populations that are seeking to leave. So these models are a response to the kind of massive migration movements to Europe in 2015 when about 1 million people are said to have crossed the sea. And of course, you know, populism is on the rise and it is a serious concern of many, but the deterrence of people and the, you know, leaving them in abject situations is definitely not the answer.
Well, what do you say to people and to governments who say that Europe cannot shoulder the influx of migrants, and that if they institute a policy of welcoming migrants to the continent, then their resources, their infrastructure will be overrun?
So I think these invasion narratives are commonly employed by European policymakers and governments to, in some ways, whip up fear. And this is really a concern because in many ways we are not facing an invasion. Yes, surely we are seeing rising numbers of people moving toward Europe. But if you compare to other countries that have for many years taken in large numbers of refugees and migrants, then of course you can say that Europe, especially with its resources and its wealth, can take in many more.
Right. For example, Lebanon has something like, what, 1 to 2 million refugees from Syria and or Iraq, correct?
Yes. Surely Jordan, Turkey, and Lebanon have taken in millions of people. And the kind of invasion narrative that I just mentioned seems to only apply to when it concerns European countries, right? So these countries have taken in many people for many years, and we have not really thought about it as a similar crisis in the past years, but only when it reached Europe in 2015 turned into this emergency.
What's happened to the numbers of people arriving in Italy after the EU struck this deal with Turkey?
So we can probably see and expect a shift in migration, right? This is always what people who critically engage with migration say, is that these forms of deterrence will not work in a sense that people just will not come anymore. But the issue is that people will still try to come, and they will try to do so by using ever more dangerous and lengthy and costly routes. So, for example, we can see probably very soon and maybe already now a shift to, again, Libya, which is a highly unstable country, where usually in the past few years a lot of sub-Saharan Africans traveled through. But with the shift now to the closure of the Aegean Sea, we can probably expect more Syrians to come also through Libya and other places such as Egypt.
Yeah, no question that the Aegean Sea, the route from Turkey to the Greek islands via the Aegean, was the easiest route by sea?
In many ways it was, because the distances are very short, right? So if you stand on the Turkish side, you can see the Greek island of Lesbos, for example. You can even see buildings. You know, it's a small stretch of water. But of course it is also very dangerous.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Maurice Stierl joins us. He is visiting assistant professor at the University of California, Davis, where he is a member of the Comparative Border Studies Initiative. And his research and much of his writing focuses on migration struggles in contemporary Europe and on activist interventions in the Mediterranean Sea. So part of your project, Maurice, seems to be about reimagining the sea, reimagining what the Mediterranean Sea is in particular. First, what is the conventional imaginary of the sea that you are kind of pushing back against?
Okay, so the sea now in many imaginaries has become this deadly deterrent, right? We talk about a fluid graveyard, we talk about the cemetery, which is the Mediterranean, and so on. And it has firstly not always been the case, and secondly, the death at sea are not natural phenomena. And that is, I think, what I find very concerning in dominant debates, that quite often the death of people is naturalized as if it was related to, say, the natural elements, right, to the waves, the winds, and so on. But of course, the Mediterranean Sea is also a very political space and has been used as a border deterrent. So I'm trying to unpack the sea and the ways in which the sea has been used by border practitioners to create a space where people drown, even if, of course, say, it is not an act of killing in most cases, but it is a form of letting die.
The conventional imaginary, as you've written about, presents a view of the sea as an untamed void, as a place that escapes human imprint. What indicates to you that this is not, in fact, the case with the Mediterranean?
So the Mediterranean Sea has become much more monitored and governed in the past few years. Also, it is frequented by commercial vessels all the time. So I think we have to move away from the idea that the sea is as you know, Carl Schmitt maybe said, is antithetical to that of land. It is not necessarily a void, but it is a political space. It is a space that has been used for commercial exploitation and so forth.
And in the context of a discourse that, as you said, stresses how people are getting swallowed up by the Mediterranean, you know, in terms of the waves and the wind and the natural elements, in this discourse, what happens in terms of whether blame is assigned or not assigned to Europe?
What I find fascinating about the Mediterranean Sea is that the idea of blame is quite often turned into the demand for humanitarian gestures, right? So because nobody can really be blamed, you know, because it seems to be a sort of quasi-natural catastrophe that is happening, we see a lot of reactions that are formulated around the notion of humanitarianism, of course, in many ways reinforcing the duality between rescuers and those who need to be rescued, and the kind of racialization of vulnerable populations that are at sea. So what I find interesting is to think about how the sea is not only turned into a very deadly deterrent, but also how reactions then to the death is quite often framed in humanitarian ways, so that the idea of Europe as a kind of normative power, as a force for good, kind of plays into this narrative, whereas, of course, in the first place, Europe has really contributed to making that place deadly.
How so?
So we have to unpack the ways in which borders are being governed. So quite often we think about borders still in this very kind of sovereign-centric way, where borders are walls at the edges of sovereign territories. But borders have really transformed, right? They are becoming inscribed into policies. They are becoming inscribed into, for example, the global visa regime, which always already impedes various people, many people in the world from leaving or from traveling to places they would like to travel to. And we see other forms of border policies, such as bilateral agreements between member states of the European Union and, say, Libya. There was the deal between Libya and Italy until a few years ago, where Gaddafi's regime was given a lot of money to protect the European border in many ways. So we see how the borders are shifting. So we call this process the process of border externalization, border outsourcing, so that it is not only sovereign states who actually govern borders, but quite often it is international organizations, sometimes it is even private citizens.
Yeah, and so you're right that deaths in the Mediterranean constitute border violence, which in some ways is a striking statement, but which in many ways, based on what you're saying, is an obvious assertion.
I do think that the problem at hand is not really rocket science. You know, we can really see how people use more and more dangerous paths because, first, land borders have been closed, because the easiest routes toward Europe are, you know, becoming more and more militarized, securitized, and so less permeable. So what it means is that people will have to make use of smugglers. And having to make use of smugglers quite often means that, you know, travel to Europe becomes more costly, which in effect also means that smuggling can turn actually into trafficking, because if you run out of money, if you need to use kind of more and more criminal networks, then of course the vulnerability of the people increases, and then also the ways in which they may be exploited.
So we're going to talk about a number of specific events and tragedies over the course of our time together. In October 2013, a man named Mohana Jamo, correct my pronunciation please, was on a boat leaving Libya. He was among hundreds of travelers trying to cross the Mediterranean. What happened to the boat, and who did this man reach out to?
So what happened there was that the vessel left from Libya. There were more than 300 people on deck, and they entered a situation of distress. And luckily, Dr. Mohamed Jamo had a satellite phone, and he had actually saved the phone number of the MRCC Rome, which is the Maritime Rescue Coordination Center. So they called. He called them up, and he asked for, obviously, you know, quick support and a rescue operation, and was basically told to call the Maltese rescue service, because apparently, following their account, the boat was in Maltese territory. So in the aftermath, then a few hours later, there were quarrels between Italy and Malta on the question over, you know, who should actually go and rescue. The rescue was delayed by several hours, and when the rescue agencies arrived, a lot of people had drowned, and also including Dr. Jammer's two children. So it was interesting to see how, and quite horrible to see, how a delay was then also covered up afterwards. So there was no investigation, and this kind of falls into the idea of the sea as this lawless space, right? And of course, if it had happened on land, you know, in 260 people had died, and it was clear that state agency had not helped or at least delayed rescue considerably, there would surely be an investigation.
Maurice Stierl joins us in studio. He is visiting assistant professor in cultural studies and African American and African studies at UC Davis, and he is a member of the activist project Watch the Med Alarm Phone, which I will bring up with him very soon, and of the research collectives CritNet, Mob Lab, and New Keywords Collective. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. So, yes, this Watch the Med, as in Watch the Mediterranean, alarm phone, it was launched in October 2014, on the one-year anniversary of this shipwreck that involved Mr. Jammo and all these other travelers. Was that the main motivating factor behind this new initiative?
So the initiative arose out of outrage about what was going on, not just in this particular case, but over many, many years in the Mediterranean Sea. So we have had deaths for the last decade or so. And the idea was to really increase pressure on European border authorities to go and rescue. So this was kind of the immediate concern. But the much larger critique was, of course, to rethink the Mediterranean Sea and to make, in the end, sea crossings unnecessary.
And who created the alarm phone and who staffs it? How does it work?
Various individuals, groups, activist communities, migrant communities have joined forces to launch this direct intervention at sea, because quite often before we had organized around the issue of death at sea, but of course, you know, we always kind of came too late. People had already died at sea. So the idea was to move from an after-the-fact intervention to actually a real-time intervention and to offer a hotline, if you will, to people in distress at sea. So we have volunteers all over the place. We are now about 120 people. Many are located in Europe, in Northern Africa, also in Turkey, and some also in the US. So the phone runs 24/7, and at any moment in time, there are people behind the phone ready if we did get a call from the Mediterranean Sea. We have also a large network of supporters. We have, for example, a social media team. We have a language team. You know, of course, we cannot always have individuals behind the phone who speak 5-6 languages. So quite often we have to pass on the phone to people who actually speak, say, Tigrinya or Farsi or Arabic.
And how do people know the number so that they call when they're in distress at sea?
So we have a very large activist network that is also situated in places where people leave from, so say in Turkey, in Morocco, in Tunisia, and Libya is not really accessible at the moment. And quite often we found that actually distributing the number via the web, via social media, is a very good way to do so. And interestingly, we have created this really large network of supporters and Syrian refugees, for example, who circulate the number amongst Syrian communities and future travelers, say through Facebook or through WhatsApp and so on. So we have these networks where the number started to circulate in 2014, and especially now after 2015, where we were involved in so many cases, the number has really been spread.
Okay, so let's say a call comes in to this alarm phone. It's called the Watch the Med alarm phone. And let's say it's a call, it's a distress call from somebody on a boat in the Mediterranean Sea. What is the standard MO? What is the approach that staffers of this hotline would use?
We created specific handbooks for the different maritime spaces in the Mediterranean Sea. So, for example, we have a handbook for the Western Mediterranean Sea telling us how to behave in distress situations between Morocco and Spain. We have similar handbooks for the spaces between Libya and Italy and between Turkey and Greece. We have these specific handbooks because the situation is always very different. You know, the size of boats differ, the modalities of communication differ, the languages differ because quite often there are different populations on these boats. So when a call comes in, we firstly have to establish where it comes from. And we can do that in various ways. If they have, for example, a smartphone, it is very easy to actually find out their location, you know, sending us their GPS position via Google Maps or via WhatsApp. So there are all these different technologies available. When it comes to other border regions or other maritime regions, it becomes a bit more tricky. For example, in the Western Mediterranean Sea, a lot of sub-Saharan Africans who make the journeys do not have smartphones. So they quite often have old phones, so they can actually not send us their GPS. So we try to establish where they are located by asking them where they left from, when they left from that place, and where they seek to go. In the case of Libya, it is again different because we have quite often very large vessels and people do not have smartphones, not even phones sometimes, and they would also be useless because in the central Mediterranean there's no reception. So quite often one person holds a satellite phone. And if we can get hold of a person with a satellite phone, we can actually quite easily ask for the GPS position that they can then read out to us.
So let's say you do get the fairly precise location of the boat, then what? Then what kind of aid do you mobilize in reaction to this call?
Once we have mapped the location, we look into what kind of area they are in and what state authority, for example, would be responsible in that particular area. So we have maps that show the different kind of territorial lines, the international water and the central Mediterranean. And also we can look into other maps that exist that, for example, show the real-time movements of cargo vessels. So once we've located a boat in distress, we see who is around, who is responsible, and who would be available if we wanted to make this case public.
Well, one thing that must guide your approach, Maurice, and you are, again, an active member of this Watch the Med alarm phone activist project, is the inclination of various, for example, state authorities or coast guards to actually mobilize in an effective way to rescue the people who are in distress. And, you know, what do we know about how vigilant and conscientious European rescue operations are with respect to migrant vessels?
I think that also depends on the different regions and what coast guards, for example, are responsible. And so we've seen how different coast guards react differently to distress calls that we bring to them. So we've had cases where, you know, they were very keen to learn more about us and what we do and what we stand for. And in other cases, they were very dismissive. You know, they didn't want others to basically interfere in their everyday work. So for us, it's this kind of dual dimension that we see ourselves as performing, which is to, at the one hand, obviously collaborating with border authorities and coast guards so that they locate certain vessels and can go out and rescue. But we also see ourselves as a type of controller of border controllers so that I can monitor and hold accountable these coast guards, some of which have not only abandoned vessels in the past, but others have directly attacked refugee vessels and turned them back. So These are the so-called pushback mechanisms where, for example, boats between Greece and Turkey were intercepted, sometimes still in Turkish water, or when in Greek water, were returned to Turkey, which is, of course, a huge violation of refugee rights.
Right. Aren't there international maritime conventions that supposedly protect these travelers?
Yes, there's the law of the sea, the humanitarian conventions, there are refugee conventions that, for example, prohibit refoulement, which means that someone is not allowed to be returned to a place where he or she may fear prosecution. But quite often, and that ties into this kind of imaginary of the sea as a lawless space, these regimes and these laws are quite often ignored.
Maurice Stierl is his name, S-T-I-E-R-L. He's a visiting assistant professor at the University of California, Davis, where, again, he is also a member of the Comparative Border Studies Initiative. We'll take a short break and speak more with Maurice. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Joining us in studio is Maurice Stierl. He is a visiting assistant professor in cultural studies and African American and African studies at UC Davis. Before moving to the U.S., he was an early career fellow at the Institute of Advanced Study and a teacher of world politics at the University of Warwick in the U.K., and his research focuses on migration struggles in contemporary Europe, and I'm focusing with him today on a couple of articles he's written. He's written many articles about the issue of people traveling by sea to Europe in recent years. You write that the Watch the Med alarm phone, the hotline we've been talking about, is part of the Mobile Commons. What is that?
The Mobile Commons is a concept that came out of a literature that is quite often referred to as the autonomy of migration, where migration is understood as a social force. So Mobile Commons are ways in which people organize under the surface. So networks that are established by people on the move, diasporas, and migrant communities that facilitate unruly movement or unauthorized movement through information exchange, knowledge exchange, through material supports, financial support.
Yeah, and this runs against this image of people as fairly well connected and sharing information and in some sense developing an underground, I think you call it an underground world of knowledge. It stands kind of in opposition to many mainstream characterizations of these people as sort of marginal, victimized and helpless.
Yes, so in my work, I also try to contest the ways in which migrant and refugees are portrayed, so quite often as vulnerable subjects, as those who need kind of our Western support, if you will, but as people who kind of find their way, right, who overcome borders, who struggle on. And so I see them as political subjects. So in my activist networks, we do not see them as helpless subjects who we, support, but we see ourselves as being in solidarity with them because we see that their struggles and our struggles are interconnected.
I would think that most people who know about this situation would think of the struggles of the people trying to cross the Mediterranean as struggles of survival, and you want to call them political struggles. What's the political element here?
So sea crossings in particular are quite often thought of as, you know, these pure struggles for survival. And of course, in the situation of being at sea, it is exactly that. It is about finding ways to cross the sea, to survive the sea and not to drown. But at the same time, you know, the framing of these struggles as purely around survival quite often depoliticizes them. And what I want to do is to repoliticize them, right? To think them within a highly politicized and political context in which barriers are created against them that they had to overcome many times. So the sea quite often is only one other obstacle that they seek to overcome. You know, quite often they have left places that they were not allowed to leave in the first place. They have struggled on sometimes for many years. And I was always thinking about why we cannot think about them as forms of political resistance or political struggles. Quite often the idea or the notion of resistance is, you know, always heroicized in many ways. It is very visible, whereas migration is either hyper-visibilized as, you know, the forms of invasion and the migrant tsunami, the flood, and so on, or invisibilized, right, as merely struggles for survival. So I wanted to rethink these struggles as political struggles.
You're right that the Watch the Med alarm phone, that its politics is an embodiment, it's related somehow to international citizenship. By international citizenship, do you mean national citizenship expanded or supplemented?
No, I do not think that it is just, you know, the kind of traditional understanding of citizenship as we have it, so which is quite often thought of as this purely formal status that is given to someone through the state. But international citizenship is a counter-citizenship, and I relate this notion to a statement given by Michel Foucault, who called for solidarity with Vietnamese boat people who had left their country due to the conflict and the war there, and had taken to the sea, very similar to the refugee movements that we can see today. And he called for solidarity not for humanitarian gestures per se, right? So he talked about how, because we are all governed in some ways, we are joined in solidarity. And so this is why I want to think about international citizenship, which goes beyond the very state-centric, the very kind of settlerist frame in which citizenship is usually framed.
Yeah, and in fact, you make very clear in your writings that this alarm phone is really, I mean, it has a humanitarian effect, but it's not a primarily humanitarian project. And you've already mentioned how part of it is pressuring or bringing to light European authorities and their practices. How much of it is about movement and asserting a kind of freedom of movement that many people would wish to have but often don't?
A lot of our members come from the no borders and freedom of movement kind of context, where they have struggled in various different localities and regions for the rights of refugees and migrants, the ability to cross certain borders. And I think especially in our very bordered and violent world, the call for freedom of movement is something that is not necessarily as utopian as people always think, because we see it being enacted. So I'm always, you know, interested in the ways in which this freedom of movement is actually taken. So it is not given by states, it's not given by governments, as is citizenship. It is not usually given to minority subjects, but it is taken, it is struggled for, and so is the freedom to move. And we have seen, especially in 2015, when about 1 million people, you know, did not allow state governments and border practitioners to stop them from moving, but they've taken the right and they've found very creative ways quite often to overcome certain borders.
Getting back to the nuts and bolts, so around how many calls has the alarm phone received, and what is your sense of the degree to which it has been able to help in one way or another people in danger at sea?
I cannot quite say how many calls we've had, because there were so many, but we've dealt with at least 1,600 emergency cases in the three Mediterranean regions. And our level of support has, of course, varied. You know, sometimes it was really just to monitor a boat that was going, say, from Turkey to Greece and ensure that the people actually arrived and were safe. And then also after arrival, that people started looking for them, because, of course, they end up quite often on islands that are not inhabited, or, you know, where no social networks and care workers are nearby. So we quite often alerted Coast Guards and local authorities to groups that were in distress even after arriving on land. So we've, I think, helped in many ways to guarantee a less dangerous journey. And quite often we've had information that state authorities did not have and that we then passed on. And obviously we insisted that they would share the steps they had taken to actually conduct rescue operations.
My name is C.S. Song, and I'm joined in studio by Maurice Stierl. He is a visiting assistant professor at UC Davis, and he is part of the Comparative Border Studies Initiative there. And he focuses a lot on migration struggles in contemporary Europe. He teaches on that topic, as well as on activist interventions in the Mediterranean Sea, of which he is a part. And we've been talking a lot about Watch the Med Alarm Phone. It's an activist project. It's a hotline to which Maurice contributes a lot of his time and energy. And as you said before, the hotline, the staffers at the hotline, they alert not just state authorities, but non-state operations that might be able to help with rescues. What should we know about these so-called, well, I guess some of them are called civilian fleets, right? What should we know about their prevalence and their responsiveness and why they are involved in rescuing people?
So the involvement of more and more civilian actors at sea is a very recent phenomenon. So a few years ago, the first vessel entered the Central Mediterranean Sea, which was MOAS, the migrant offshore aid station, which was initiated by an Italian-American couple that really acted on a humanitarian sentiment after, you know, witnessing all these tragedies at sea. With them entering the sea, I think they set a sort of precedent where, you know, they showed to people that, yes, we are civilian actors, but we can actually enter this space, which is quite often seen as, you know, very reserved for, say, security and state actors. So afterwards, we saw, for example, Doctors Without Borders contributing first to the MOAS mission and then also having two of their own vessels in the Central Mediterranean Sea. Now we've seen other actors such as Sea-Watch, which is a private initiative which first was started by a couple of German families actually roaming the Mediterranean Sea. We see SOS Mediterranee, which is another vessel. We see the CI, yet another vessel. And some of them also have smaller interventions in the Aegean Sea as well. So we can see the kind of humanitarianization of the sea. And while I, of course, think in many ways this is great, right? Because also through the alarm phone, we quite often now have actually actors who are at sea. And sometimes we can call the crews and actually direct them to distress calls that we were alerted to, or the distress cases. At the same time, I see a kind of problematic dimension in it, because some of them frame the interventions purely in a humanitarian way, right? So for them, it doesn't really matter what happens to people after they have been brought to Italy, for example. But what only counts is the survival of people. Of course, this is an element of humanitarian action that we see all over the place. But what I think is concerning is the lack of kind of political engagement with the structure and conditions that actually have allowed for these, you know, quite often deadly and precarious situations in the first place. So MOAS in particular, I think, is a bit problematic, because the initial funding for this project was based on a kind of service that was offered by the initiators, which is called Tangiers Group, which is an insurance company that also insured, for example, private security people from the U.S. going into Afghanistan and Iraq, right? So it's interesting how there is an absence or maybe a lack of engagement with structural forces that lead to migration movements. And, of course, we can see that large migration movements from Iraq and Afghanistan still occur.
But might it not be true that humanitarian actors who are operating these vessels, that, you know, over time, as they understand the, say, lack of responsiveness of European, you know, coast guards or other authorities in relation to these drowning, distressed people, that's got to spur a kind of political consciousness among these people who claim to be only humanitarian or to be acting only in humanitarian ways?
Yes, I'm sure that there is the kind of possibility for like transitioning toward a more politicized stance. And I think definitely actors who've been there, you know, who have not experienced this before, you know, Doctors Without Borders, for example, of course, has very experienced teams, but others who maybe act on very humanitarian rationales and who are private individuals and families, I think they have also transitioned quite often after seeing what is actually going on at sea. And to also really witness how there's a lack of rescue capacity, although Europe has, you know, continuously militarized the sea. So there's a lack of rescue, although you have all these military vessels nearby. And I think through this experience, some of these humanitarians have moved beyond the rationale or, you know, the kind of pure rescue rationale toward a more politicized stance.
Okay, so let's say the alarm phone responds to a distress call, and let's say the vessel is rescued, the people on the vessel is rescued, and they actually make it to the shores of Europe. So is the alarm phone project's role over when the traveler successfully makes the sea crossing?
So the alarm phone really focuses on facilitating these precarious movements, right? So once they've reached land, quite often we say we close the case. At the same time, you know, if we continue to be in touch with the travelers, you know, we have relationships that formed during the situation of distress and lasted after people had reached land, for example, in Greece, and then moved on via the Balkan route toward, you know, Central European places. And some people actually met those that we, you know, first contacted when they were at sea. So there are these solidarities that are formed also beyond the situation of, you know, acute emergency. And what we quite often do is that when we know that they have reached land and we still have contact to them, we can pass on further information, further contacts to, say, lawyers, you know, legal support, to other networks that we know that work in the places that they have arrived in or they want to move toward. So I think there are these different networks that are overlapping quite often so that people can, you know, seek support wherever they are, even after they have crossed the sea.
And this network is really a two-way street, isn't it? You are learning from successful crossers, and you must be accumulating a certain kind of knowledge about what it takes to get across the Mediterranean and to make further journeys overland.
So the knowledges that we have accumulated through this project are immense. And what I think I need to express is that a lot of the inspirations for this project came from people who had once crossed the sea themselves, right? Also, an Eritrean priest called Father Musi Zarai, and you may have heard of him because he was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize in 2015, who had basically done the job for a decade or so, especially for Eritrean and migrants who sought to cross from Tunisia or from Libya. So he had done it, and we took inspiration from his work, and we connected with him, and we also learned from other people who had actually crossed the sea, because it is not just about, you know, learning about certain routes and so on. It is about really learning about the experience, you know, how it feels to be at sea, how a journey is organized, you know, what people have with them when they cross the sea, and, you know, how we can support them based on these different materialities and knowledges.
What about public pressure campaigns? Does the Watch the Med alarm phone engage in such activities?
Yes, so we have different sorts of public pressure campaigns. So when we announced our project, we made very clear also to the different Coast Guards that we are not just, you know, service providers. We are not just passing on information to them so that they can act on it, but we will also control them. And if we have the feeling that they do not do their best to rescue people, we've said that, yes, we would do public pressure campaigns. So we've done that a couple of times. We've also related campaigns such as, you know, Ferries Not Frontex, which is a call and also a campaign to provide for much safer ways to cross the Mediterranean Sea. We are, you know, we're involved in obviously public demonstrations and so forth. Yeah.
Frontex being the European border agency?
Yes, Frontex is the European border agency that was founded in 2004, and, you know, the budget has just become kind of out of control over the past few years. And it is a symbol for European border deterrence.
You said earlier that when the alarm phone, okay, so it hears a distress call, it gets a distress call, and then it calls maybe some kind of a state authority, and often they're kind of interested in you and what you're doing. That suggests to me that sometimes the alarm phone has actually been targeted by authorities. Is that the case?
I wouldn't say that we have been targeted so far. I think there was a concern of, you know, being criminalized, because we see how state authorities are trying to clamp down not only on illegal, so-called illegal migration, but also on those networks that support so-called illegal forms of migration. So we can see how volunteers in Greece are becoming increasingly criminalized, how volunteers in Greece have to now notify the police if they actually want to act on the Greek islands, for example. So we see how activist groups and so on are becoming governed by state authorities. Our network, I think, is not being criminalized so far. And what is interesting, actually, is that Coast Guards were very skeptical in the beginning when we called them. But of course, over the many months that we engage with them, sometimes, I don't know, 20 times a day, they now know us. So when we say we are the Watch the Met alarm phone, usually we get a very open response.
I know the alarm phone activists, the Watch the Med alarm phone activists, do not see the hotline as a solution to the crisis. What do they see? What do you see as the solution to the crisis?
So there are various short-term solutions or approaches, and then long-term ideas of how we can really deal with the situation that we are currently facing. The network, exactly as you said, does not see this alarm phone as a solution to a problem, because of course it's only patching up what has been created by the European border regime. So what we argue for in the long term is a de-borderization. So whereas we can see novel kind of deals with states in Africa, in Turkey and elsewhere, we argue that we have to actually do the opposite. We have to find ways to make journeys less dangerous and less deadly by creating forms of, you know, illegal and safe migration routes.
And how concretely might that work?
So firstly, I think it is really important to shift the narrative. Right. We have become stuck in this crisis modus of understanding migration. So everything is dealt with in an emergency modus. But of course, we are not really facing a huge humanitarian crisis per se, just because people are trying to reach Europe. But the ways in which migration paths are being deterred, you know, causes humanitarian crises to occur in the first place. Okay, so at first we have to think about very short-term solutions that are available. So, of course, you know, taking in much larger numbers of people who are actually fleeing. And I do think that Europe has the space and the wealth to accommodate many, many more. And we have to shift away from the idea of, you know, people being an invasion. So these ways in which people become figures, you know, threatening individuals and so on. We have to deconstruct that. And that way we also respond to populist ideas about kind of the other, that always racialize the other as a threat, you know, as a danger to Western or European ways of life and so on. So I think In terms of kind of short-term solution, we have to allow more and more people to enter the union to find safety. They're fleeing conflict, persecution, poverty, and so forth, and they have the right to find safety and protection. So that's a short-term strategy. In the long term, we have to also kind of struggle against the ways in which we kind of border the world. We have to think about alternative ways of kind of living communally. And the European Union always sees itself as a force for good, an open society without internal borders. And of course, we see now that it is also a bit of a myth. But if it wants to stand up to certain norms and values that it at least declares, then I think, you know, there has to be a shift in the ways in which they deal with the issue of migration.
Maurice Stierl, S-T-I-E-R-L, visiting assistant professor at UC Davis and a member of a number of activist projects and research collectives, including Watch the Med Alarm Phone, has written widely on migration struggles in contemporary Europe. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against. Many thanks to Erica Bridgman, who's at the controls today.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.